Good morning. It is now 9:07, and we're going to call the meeting to order. Colleagues, if you'll take your seats. This morning for our invocation, we have Felicia Hill with the Life Church Dallas in District 12. Felicia Hill is the prayer director of the Life Church in Dallas, where she is responsible for planning, coordinating, and overseeing weekly prayer meetings, 24 hours of prayer events, annual prayer walks, and daily prayer requests from the church and community. In addition, Felicia offers prayer training classes. She is a graduate of Dallas Baptist University at Purpose Institute Ministerial College and American Trades Institute. Felicia is very active in the community where she participates in the Diabetes Health and Wellness 5K, the Susan B. Komen 5K, Feeding the Homeless of Dallas at the Salvation Army, and Cornerstone Baptist Church. She is also a strong advocate for the Dallas Hearts and Hammers program. She was born and raised in Shreveport, Louisiana, and has been a Dallas resident since 1986. She is a proud parent of two great sons. All rise.
Father, in the name of Jesus, we thank you for this beautiful day that we've gathered here today, God, to do your great work. We humble our hearts in your presence, and we ask you first, Father, to forgive us of our sins. Lord, we thank you for your hand upon the city of Dallas, for Dallas is a great city. We're asking you today in the name of Jesus that you will be with every city council member here represented today to do your great will for this city. We ask you as they meet that you would give them a spirit of unity. Oh God, we pray that you would give them divine wisdom, divine guidance. We pray that you will influence them, oh God, in every decision that they are making today in the name of Jesus. Let there be no division among us in Jesus' name. Father, we ask that you would heal the city of Dallas. Heal every relationship in the name of Jesus. Give us a mighty spiritual awakening. Give us peace in this city. Give us protection in the name of Jesus. Oh God, bless us with prosperity. In Jesus' mighty name, we thank you today. In Jesus' name, amen.
Councilmember Magoo.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem. It is my pleasure to welcome today to City Hall Boy Scout Troop 435. And these young gentlemen will help lead us in the pledge this morning.
Color Guard attention. Salute. Color Guard, post the colors. Halt. Color Guard, cross the colors. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the power of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Please join me in the Texas Pledge. Honor the Texas flag. I pledge allegiance to the Texas, one state, under God, indivisible.
Thank you. Let's give them a round of applause. You may be seated. We have two special presentations. At this time, Councilmember Narez and Deputy Mayor Pro Tem Medrano.
Good morning. Good morning, colleagues. Over the past few years, I haven't really asked for too many proclamations to be done. I hold these very, very dear and I think that they are only for the most special, special occasions or for the most special persons. And so a couple weeks ago or a few weeks ago, I gave my first ever in my first two-year term. And then this time around, I asked Deputy Mayor Pro Tem, since he is our chair of the LGBT Task Force, if we could, if he would join me in honoring this next individual. This is Pride Month across the, not just the nation, but the entire world. And this year is even more significant than other years because this is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, which launched the modern day LGBT rights, LGBT civil rights movement. And a lot of folks ask, you know, we'll say, what is pride? And pride means something different to many individuals. For some, it's about protest and rioting and fighting back for your civil rights. And for others, it's a celebration of being able to be out loud and proud of who you are. For me, it's many different things. When I was elected 2 years ago, I was the first out council member in a decade elected to this council. I'm really excited that there's now two out city council members, and in a week there will be three of us on this council, which is really exciting because of the top 12 cities in the nation. We will have the highest percentage of openly LGBT members of any city council of those top 12 cities in the entire nation. So that gives me a lot of pride that, you know, there was a day when I couldn't be who I wanted to be out and loud and openly because society said I was not allowed to be. But there's an individual who probably, while I was still struggling with who I was, that was out fighting a strong and valiant fight in our community, especially the gay men's community, but all communities, whether you're gay, straight, lesbian, bisexual, or a person of the trans experience, there was a crisis, an epidemic that had started in this nation, in this world, called HIV/AIDS. Before then, we didn't even have a name for it. It was just called the gay cancer. And this individual, his name is Don Mason, was out there fighting the good fight before we knew what it was. He watched friends die. He watched families fall apart. But he stayed valiant. And so this one is really important to me. So we're going to do a proclamation to him because he just recently retired his 30-plus years of saving lives.
So the special recognition reads, whereas in the late 1980s, when AIDS was reaching an epidemic proportions, devastating large segments of the gay community in Dallas, fear, confusion, and discrimination were rampant. And whereas a tremendous need for housing and services existed for those impacted by the disease, who were often rejected by families, friends, and community and left with nowhere to live and few options for treatment. In 1989, Don Mason and others came together to form AIDS Services of Dallas. And whereas Mr. Mason became president and CEO of AIDS Services of Dallas, under his leadership, it became one of the largest housing programs in the United States for people living with AIDS, which includes supportive housing and assisted living facilities to low-income individuals and families with HIV and AIDS. And whereas Mr. Mason has shared his vast experience and wisdom in dealing with the AIDS pandemic through his service in other organizations, he has served as co-chair and board member of the National AIDS Housing Coalition and has served with the Enterprise Foundation Network Advisory Committee, National AIDS Communications Roundtable, Texas AIDS Network, and whereas on February 1st, 2019, Don Mason retired as president and CEO of AIDS Services of Dallas after 32 years of impactful, devoted service to the HIV/AIDS and LGBTQ communities in Dallas. Whereas the City of Dallas commends Don Mason for his dedication to the HIV/AIDS community, the LGBTQ community, and for making Dallas a kinder, just, and more welcoming place to live. Now, therefore, I, Adam Madrona, on behalf of Michael S. Rawlings, the mayor of the City of Dallas, and on behalf of the Dallas City Council, on June 5, 2019, hereby extend special recognition to Mr. Don Mason.
members of the council, Mayor Rollins, my colleagues, thank you very much for this recognition. I'm very proud of what we've accomplished here in Dallas at AIDS Services of Dallas. We now have 5 facilities here in the city. We have 4 senior projects that are not HIV related, but are affordable housing in some of the outlying areas, Plano, Richardson, Louisville, and Mesquite. We're very proud of the recognition you've given me, and we appreciate all the hard work that the city staff has done at administering the Housing Opportunities with Persons with AIDS program, particularly Lori Davidson, who's a godsend to y'all and your staff. Thank you very much.
Mayor Pro Tem, we can take a picture, please. And while my colleagues are coming up, I just want to announce that this afternoon at noon, we are going to be hosting our City of Dallas Pride celebration. On the first floor in the main lobby, we will be unveiling the Pride flag in the lobby like we have for probably the last 5 or 6 years now. And stick around because we have another surprise for Mr. Mason during that noon hour. So if you're here after the briefing, join us during the lunch hour. Thank you.
So I have another proclamation on behalf of the mayor. This month is also Immigrant Heritage Month, so I'm going to read that proclamation. It reads, whereas generations of immigrants from every corner of the globe have built our country's economy and created the unique character of our nation, and whereas immigrants continue to grow businesses, innovate, strengthen our economy, and create American jobs in Dallas, and whereas immigrants have provided the United States with unique social and cultural influence, fundamentally enriching the extraordinary character of our nation, and whereas immigrants have been tireless leaders not only in securing their own rights and access to equal opportunity, but have also campaigned to create a fairer and more just society for all Americans. And whereas despite these countless contributions, the role of immigrants in building and enriching our nation is something that we all should continue to advocate for. And whereas our immigrant neighbors enhance our communities through their cultural and economic contributions by maintaining a compassionate spirit, we can ensure the strength, diversity, and vibrance of Dallas for generations to come. Now, therefore, I, Adam Medrano, on behalf of the Mayor Michael S. Rawlings, and on behalf of Dallas City Council, do hereby proclaim the month of June 2019 as Immigrant Heritage Month in Dallas, Texas. I believe somebody was going to accept. I think we're taking another picture, folks.
Would like to thank the City Council for approving in October the welcoming plan that our 85-member task force worked on for a year, and under the leadership of Liz Cedillo Pereira and Vanna Slaughter and the Office of Welcoming Communities and Immigrant Affairs. My name is Linda Abramson-Evans, and I'm only one of those 85, and a few of us are here today. And we would also like to present our Deputy Pro Tem, Mayor Pro Tem, with Welcoming America's official welcoming T-shirt. Hey.
Councilmember Magoo.
Thank you, Mayor. Before we get started, I also want to recognize and thank Riley Flodine from Troop 890 of Lake Highlands here with his mom, Suzanne. He is working on earning his Citizen in Community badge, and I appreciate you being here today. Thank you, sir.
All right. Before we start with our speakers, let's kind of go over the layout for today. Around 11, somewhere between 11:15 and 11:30, we'll recess for lunch, so we'll have time for to get set up for the program that's going to take place, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock for our afternoon session. Okay? All right. Desiree?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This morning, your first five registered speakers will be Daryl Blair, Jacob Vermevlin, Devontae Peters, Charles Mann, and Terrence Hines. I'll recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of the City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council shall be removed from the room. Individuals are given 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the time at the monitor in front of you. When your time is up, please stop. Address your comments to Mayor Thomas only. Also, if you have any handouts, go ahead and hand it to the officer to my right, as it will affect your speaking time. Your first speaker, Daryl Blair. Not present, Jacob Vermevlin.
Mayor Rollins, City Councilmen and women, and visiting members of the public. Thank you for allowing me to address the Dallas City Council today. My name is Jacob Vermevlin. I'm a Life Scout of Troop 435 in Lake Highlands. And I serve this spring as the Troop Senior Patrol Leader. Today I am here to discuss the importance of emergency preparedness and to offer you the assistance of the members of Troop 435. The Boy Scout motto, Be Prepared, has guided scouts for decades to prepare for all types of emergencies. On May 10, 2003, the Department of Homeland Security and the Boy Scouts of America launched a partnership to assist individuals, families, and communities in preparing for disasters. The partnership between the DHS and the Boy Scouts of America complements both of the organization's efforts in preparedness. In support of this initiative, our troop has instituted an emergency mobilization plan. In the unfortunate instance that a state of emergency is declared, our troop may be called upon to assist state and federal emergency management services, as well as local fire, EMS, and police departments. Troop 435 stands ready to assist in support of roles that can free up resources so that they can be more effectively employed elsewhere. The members of Troop 435 have received training in emergency preparedness, as signified by earning of the Emergency Preparedness Badge. Scouts who have earned the Emergency Preparedness Badge are trained to provide basic first aid and CPR. Scouts who have earned the Search and Rescue Merit Badge are trained in the foundational tenets of search and rescue operations. The members of Troop 435 can assist with search and rescue of missing children, perform as a courier service, volunteer at drop-off centers, and assist with constructing community shelters. Requests for our assistance can be made by contacting either our Scoutmaster, Bob Burke, or Troop Committee Chair, Rainey Berry. We are committed to responding to your request within 1 hour. Once again, thank you for allowing me to renew Troop 435's commitment to serving the City of Dallas in this important way. We appreciate you and your service to the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Jacob, for being here and for speaking. I'm not Mayor Rollins. I just play him on TV. But we appreciate you and your troop being here and offering your service. Councilmember.
Yeah, and could we make sure that we have someone from Emergency Office of Emergency Preparedness to meet with these young leaders? And really just want to thank y'all again. This is a troop that impacts a lot going on, whether it's putting out flags at specific events or encouraging a lot of community service and just leading in our community. And so we're very thankful for them and appreciate y'all stepping up in this way to really help with something that's impactful for our city. Thank you.
Okay. Michelle.
Devontae Peters.
Oh. Yes, my name is Devontae D. Peters, and it's good to be here, and I like the energy, how y'all are very excited about the LGBT and the other people that came up, and I just want to make sure we have the same energy, because I am here on behalf of residents of Estelle Village Apartments in Highland Hills, what we call the Pink's Apartments. These 90% of these apartments are filled with bed bugs, roaches, rats, and mold. I went and recently did a survey. I surveyed the apartments, and I was actually there for the rats, roaches, and bed bugs. But the overwhelming majority of the residents were telling me that they also have mold in over 90% of the apartments. So, and I was understanding that these apartments are city owned. So I'm here today to state that. That there needs to be a plan of action starting today on what we're going to do with these apartments. They are not livable. We have children who are suffering from eczema and asthma and things like that, and we know that it's coming from the conditions and the quality of life that they're experiencing in Estelle Village. Also, I would like to also point out that the overwhelming majority of the residents in these apartments are single black mothers. And they have to raise their kids in these conditions. And then we also know that the water in this area is contaminated by the Lane Plating Facility. And so we see some of the behaviors that the kids exhibit. And, you know, they're constantly dealing with trouble and, you know, different behaviors that are going to get them potentially, you know, in a environment that they don't want to be in. We also passed the juvenile curfew ordinance, and if y'all know West Dallas and you know how their water was poisoned and how that affected the mental state of the, you know, the residents in that area, this is the same thing that's going on in Highland Hills, and we definitely need a plan of action. I feel like City Council and the Dallas Housing Authority need to collaborate on a plan to renovate or remodel or rebuild these apartments and accommodate the people who are living there and who have been living there for 5, 10 plus years and who have been content or not content but just didn't know what they could do to address this. Well, I don't live in those apartments. I'm actually there on their behalf, so I was able to step outside of myself to try to do something for some residents. So y'all don't live there either, so I think y'all could kind of do you know, step outside of yourselves like I did today to you know, address some issues that don't affect me directly, but it does affect us all if we are residents of Dallas or elected officials of Dallas, and we're trying to market our city as a premier city, a world-class city. We cannot do that if we have apartments riddled with roaches, rats, bed bugs, and mold, and nobody's addressing that. So Devontae D. Peters, I'm here today to say, hey, let's collaborate. If y'all need some ideas, I also have surveys and studies, surveys that have the opinions and ideas of the residents in Estelle Village. Thank y'all for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Peters. Mr. Atkins?
Yes, I want to make one thing clarify, that the water at Estelle Village is safe. There is the same water that is drinking throughout the whole city of Dallas. We had checked out. Number two, is that a coal issue? TC, will you have someone from coal to meet with him and to inspect that? And those Estelle Village is not owned by the city. I think that's Dallas Housing Authority. We, the city, do not own those apartments. But we will make sure that the residents are safe. Everything we can do as a city, we will be pleased to make sure that the resident is safe in Highland Hills. Thank you very much for coming
Thank
up.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Mr. Simpson is here to talk to you. Oh, Mr. Johnson. Okay.
I just want to ask you, why haven't the changes that we made on Chapter 20 habitability standards, and why haven't they addressed these issues at Estelle?
Who's that question for, Mr. Kelly?
Is there somebody in housing that could address why those habitability standards have not been
Councilman, served? We'll discuss the specifics of Chapter 27 with DHA, which we've been in continual contact with them. It's a federal facility, so they do much of their own inspections, but we're working with them at a close proximity on okay. Chapter 27 right. compliance.
Thank you.
Michelle.
Charles Mann.
Good morning. Charles Mann, 4515 Live Oak, Old East Dallas. Ma'am, I come here before you today to say goodbye fairly well, Avidazain, via Condidos, and have a safe trip back to Never Never Land or wherever part of North Dallas you hail from. I know you'll be very happy in retirement because you have a home. Unfortunately, you're leaving Dallas some 20,000 units shy of homes for people, many of whom haven't done as well as you. That's what I really want to address. How can the city of Dallas add the necessary housing accommodations that we so urgently need right now and will continue to need in the future? I believe that with the use of new technology, it can be done. With the new 3D printing technology that is coming online, it will be possible to build small houses in about a day for under $10,000. That's remarkable. And even better, that's truly affordable. Mayor, even if you could snap your fingers and make 20,000 standard built units appear, most people wouldn't be able to use them because they wouldn't qualify for a standard loan. Possibly not even to rent. But maybe with a little help, the mortgage on a $10,000 or $20,000 small home would be doable for many people. Now, I know your real estate buddies ain't going to like this. They'll want to keep as much upward pressure on the market as possible so they can continue to raise the prices whenever they like and call it market rate. But if Dallas doesn't do something, and soon, you're going to find more and more people camping out in places you don't want them, maybe even in Never Never Land. Have a nice retirement.
Terrence Hines.
Good morning. My name is Terrence Hines, address 2808 McKinney Avenue, from District 14. As you all know, as of 10 p.m. on June 4, 2019, we were 91 homicides, with approximately 40 occurring in May. Over time, after our numbers slowly climbed in May, we would hear from the spokesperson for the Dallas Police Department. It was not until June 3rd that I realized we still had a chief of police after 40-something lives had been taken. In a news conference on June 3rd, it was said that 23 homicides was a result of conflict resolution. What has been done besides calling pastors, and other leaders of the community, what action plans have been put in place to reduce the reoccurring socioeconomic homicides of our community? A statement was also made that there are individuals who have returned from prison, who cannot find a job, who are not educated, and those individuals are forced to commit violent crimes. To the average educated American, forced means without a choice. In my research, some of the top criminals have been able to be rehabbed and are doing well in society when they have the opportunity and the resources to be a better human being. What have we put in place in the city of Dallas to assist these prisoners to have a better life, to have a better route than to commit these violent crimes and acts? A better choice of words would have been a plan to address the trend that we see in repeat offenders. The governor of Texas offered assistance with resources to come into our community and help. The response that was given on television was thank you. Is that thank you that I accept, or thank you for your offer, but I politely decline? Transparency is always a word loosely thrown around by our department, but as you can tell, there's a dark film over what is transparent in our community. Many would say, who is to blame? My response will be simple. All of us in this room are to blame. Why? Accountability. We must hold individuals accountable for the job or positions that they are holding. I have lost faith in our department from a few years back. We blame the issue on fatigue and short-staffed. We as leaders must wonder why staffing in our police department took a dive for the worst. Is it us? Why is it that people do not want to work for us? What are we doing to ensure that we have the best leaders we can be for the city of Dallas? This day forward, I will hold my elected representatives accountable. I've spoken with both mayor candidates, and whoever the best person for the job is, I will be at your office holding you accountable for holding everyone else accountable. There will be a day that I run to sit on the opposite side of this table, and I'm sure my community would want me to do all the right things that I'm asking each of you to step up and do. If there was a vote tomorrow to change the leadership in law enforcement in Dallas, I'm not confident that I could vote to retain what we have now. Thank you.
Thank you. Dolores Phillips.
You do have handouts, three pages from October 25th, 2013, when I was unlawfully arrested, taken to Green Oaks, premeditated. My name is Dolores Phillips. Address is going to be 567 West Dickey Road, Grand Prairie, Texas, 75051. October 25th, 2013, that meeting was prearranged 2 to 3 weeks prior. On page one, it says charges are other. Type one, description APOW. Page two, it states that AO worker, Belize Thorne, and Herbert Cotner met with me. What they said was, page two, if you read in page three, that I voluntarily went to Green Oaks. I drove from UNT Dallas straight to the meeting at 9 a.m., which was held on the first floor. On the first floor, there was never any disorderly conduct, never any argument. Corporal Cotner stated when I first walked in, he came to meet me, that he had spoke with Mayor Rollins earlier that morning of October 25th, 2013. Please share with Mayor Rollins that just because he's retiring and he's exhausted all his terms for mayor, he's not exempt from testifying. I will be duly and wisely clearing my name and asking for him to give a deposition to his knowledge of October 25th, 2013, and why he spoke to Corporal Cotner the morning of October 2013. I drove to 1400 South Lamar with a 3.0 GPA from UNT Dallas, where I was a student. I graduated less than 6 weeks later with a 3.0. I was there October 25th, 2013 for a prior cover-up in 2009. So 2013 was obstruction of justice again. Me and my family and my friends continue to endure the repercussions. I was told to get rid of my barbecue grill in Columbia Luxor or face eviction. They didn't release those documents. I just received the open records request this morning from open records upstairs on the fifth floor. I'm humbly sharing with you that President Trump said out of his mouth, no one is above the law. Everyone who has connections, networks and knowledge to open up. We won, get the key. I'm going to be asking you to testify. If you've received an email or phone call, I'm going to ask you to give a deposition to your knowledge. Also, I would like to say that never any doctor that I've ever seen ever diagnosed me as bipolar. DPD social worker Valise Thorne said prior to me being taken to Green Oaks, which was premeditated, that y'all were talking about me being bipolar and taking medication on a daily basis. I spoke with Corporal Cotner last year trying to find out her correct title or had it changed. He said she had passed away October 2017. She took a lot of knowledge with her, but she left a lot of notes at the same time. Tell, please share with Mayor Rollins that I'm going to be knocking on his door and that I feel sorry for DPD officers who are thrown under the bus. 200 plus officers who's on the Brady's list were set up to fail. And no, people need to know that when you throw officers under the bus, citizens are simultaneously thrown under the bus.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips.
No, thank you.
This concludes your first five registered speakers. We'll now move to your voting agenda.
All right.
Agenda item one is approval of minutes of the May 15, 2019 City Council meeting.
It's been motion seconded. We approve the minutes. All in favor, vote aye. All opposed, the same sign.
Agenda item two is consideration of appointments to boards and commissions. This morning we only have individual appointments. Nominees for individual appointments are to the Dallas Citizens Police Review Board, Julius A. McGraw is being nominated by Councilmember Kleinman. To the Civil Service Board, adjunct members, Callie Cohn is being nominated by Councilmember Kingston. To the Municipal Library Board, Xavier Allen Henderson is being nominated by Councilmember Arnold. And to the Youth Commission, Timothy Chapa is being nominated by Councilmember Narvaez.
Could entertain a motion? Second. It's been probably motion and second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor vote aye. All opposed, the same sign.
Mr. Mayor, your briefings continue.
Thank you. At this time, we are going to begin with our financial inclusion roundtable. Those who are going, our guests, as well as our colleague, Councilmember Callahan, if you'll assume a position at the desk. And once everyone is seated, we'll pitch it to you for you to set up the team that's here for the presentation.
Good morning, Mayor and colleagues. It just pleases me today to make this presentation in front of everybody. And now I've been involved with this financial inclusion roundtable for probably 3 or 4 years since Councilmember Jerry Allen left. And this organization, of course, was responsible for leading and building the payday ordinance that we've had. And now we've got about 8 or 9 million people, I think, statewide that are underneath this ordinance. So I just wanted to take the time now to introduce Mr. Greg Mangum. He's Vice President of United Way of Metropolitan Dallas, and he's joining us today to brief the City Council on the effective partnerships between financial institutions and community organizations to address financial stability and to showcase safe and affordable products and services offered to families in the Dallas area. Greg, thank you, and you can introduce the rest of our panel.
All right, thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here this morning, and I appreciate the opportunity. So our purpose here is just to do a brief recap and background on the Financial Inclusion Roundtable. And I think just as a way to start, to be clear, this has been a four-way partnership with the City of Dallas, with United Way of Metropolitan Dallas, with the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And we have representatives from those organizations here this morning. I just wanted to introduce those folks before we get started. So we have Eloy Villafranca, who's the regional manager of community affairs branch for the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Dallas region. We also have Linda Gabriel, community affairs specialist with FDIC. We've got Roy Lopez, who is the assistant vice president of community development for the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. And then, of course, all this in partnership with Councilman Callahan. Have really put together this roundtable. So you can see sort of what we'll run over. By way of background and history, so almost 7 years ago to the day, back in June of 2012, I started a role at United Way to really look at community financial stability challenges and opportunities in figuring out the solutions. And the very, very first call that I received, the very first day I was at United Way, was from Jerry Allen, Councilman Jerry Allen, who at the time was working on the payday lending ordinance and had also been involved with several banks and community organizations. And he asked me to help him convene a group of folks that really could look at this issue really for the purpose of trying to figure out, you know, as the payday lending ordinance was going to get established, you know, how could you create alternatives to make sure that people had access to fair and affordable credit? And so that really became our purpose. So Councilman Callahan kind of referred to this as, you know, stopping vulture capitalism. But really it was about, you know, curbing predatory lending, right? And figuring out what alternatives could exist in the marketplace and how we can make those connections of those alternatives between the financial institutions and community organizations. So that led us to the creation of the Financial Inclusion Roundtable. And in essence, what this is a collaborative effort that brings together financial institutions and community organizations to share and learn about ways to better connect low and moderate income families to ensure deposit accounts, fair credit, and quality financial capability programs. As I mentioned, this is a partnership between these four organizations, really trying to come together to use our resources, our connections in the community, to really build consensus around some of the challenges and solutions that are presented. One of those happens to be around just the data around unbanked, underbanked folks, as well as subprime credit. So this slide is just a snapshot. There is a study that was done back in 2012 and then again last year by Communities Foundation of Texas that looks at assets and opportunities in Dallas. And specifically, I pulled out two data points around unbanked and underbanked. The great news on this slide is the unbanked and underbanked rates are actually decreasing if you look at trends over the last 10 years. The FDIC does a regular study about looking at rates of underbanked and unbanked. And Eloy and Linda came and did a presentation several months ago that pulled out the Dallas data of a national report and helped us glean that those rates in Dallas are actually decreasing. So that's really great news. We still have a challenge around credit. So we have many people in the city that either have subprime credit scores or no credit file at all. And so it's trying to address how we can help those people access credit. So really the goals for the Financial Inclusion Roundtable, it's helping financial institutions and community organizations come together to share their perspectives and ideas, their challenges that they're having within their marketplaces, and then also best practices. We host quarterly forums that help showcase these safe and affordable products and services along with effective partnerships. We bring in outside experts, both locally and nationally, that can help inform us about emerging trends and innovative solutions that we can bring to Dallas. And we also want to maintain momentum towards strategic action. I will just tell you, I think what's worked well for us, what we found out was that having financial institutions do some sort of a mass marketing campaign really was not serving us well. There were several attempts to do that back in the 2010 timeframe. What we have found that works really well is being able to connect individual financial institutions with individual community organizations to figure out between those two organizations how can they provide access to products and services and getting more folks connected in that way. So the outcomes, really we have tried to encourage this networking, right, building relationships and trust. What we found is the banks came in They were a little reluctant to meet with community organizations because, you know, they were afraid that it was just going to be an ask for money. The community organizations came in and were kind of mad at the banks, and they're like, you know, well, they don't serve our clients, you know, and we're just mad at them. So bringing folks together, creating that sharing and learning opportunity to help them figure out how they can work together and what each of them share has been very successful for us. So we've also seen those increased partnerships activities. So the example I would give you, and there are several, but MetroCrest Services is an organization that serves in Dallas, partnered with Frost Bank. So MetroCrest is a part of their social services program, provides financial counseling and coaching. So Frost Bank came in and said, you know, hey, we're not going to go out and you know, put up a billboard to offer free checking or free savings to everybody. But for your clients, you know, your 100 or so clients that are going through financial coaching, you know, we know because of, you know, the curriculum that you're using, that these folks are likely to come in, set up accounts, and be successful in managing those accounts. So we're happy to come and partner with you to help. So we've been just working as our roundtable to help build those types of partnerships and connections. And then also expanding the table by engaging new organizations. So I just wanted to get a snapshot of a couple meetings that have occurred. Our year for the roundtable typically runs July into June. And so over the past year, we had a meeting in October that focused on small dollar loans. Again, we mentioned, you know, payday lending. So we felt that it was important to kind of cover the ground of what was available as far as reputable small dollar loan products. The FDIC has done some great research around that, so they came and did a presentation. And then we had local lender spotlights come in and highlight the work that they're doing. And I'll just call out a couple here because I think it's relevant for the city of Dallas. So the Community Loan Center, the CLC, is working with the city of Dallas, among other employers, to provide low-cost employer-based loans for employees in an employer setting. So that is one solution that has worked well and that we're looking to build upon to provide alternatives to safe and affordable credit. True Connect is another one. We're currently working with a group of employers, for-profit employers, that are looking for as a way to enhance their benefits package and also as a way of looking at job quality initiatives to improve retention and attraction of employees, looking at providing employee-sponsored loans. And so True Connect is somebody that we've been talking with on the national level that could come to Dallas and provide that. In March of this year, we had a really good forum around affordable housing. You know, as you know, there's many challenges and opportunities in this space, and so we felt we had a lot of interest in the topic, and so we were able to bring in folks to kind of talk through some of that, what were some of the challenges and opportunities that these community organizations were seeing, how were financial institutions involved in that issue area. And again, we had you know, other community spotlights as well on different lending options. So just to give you a scope of the roundtable, so far this year we've had 81 participating organizations. And I won't read through this, but just for your reference, so these are the list of financial institutions that have been involved. And then this is the list of government and community organizations that have been involved. So typically we'll have about 80 to 90 folks attend these quarterly sessions. But the real work, I think, happens after that, because what happens is these folks get together and they figure out ways within their organizations to solve for some of these intractable issues. So the conclusion is, you know, this financial literacy partnership has, you know, helped citizens gain and secure low-interest loans, obtain car loans with lower repayment plans and competitive interest rates. Really, at the end of the day, this is allowing for stability of citizens to obtain good-paying jobs and improving their quality of life and investing in the economy. And then just quickly by way of next steps, so Councilman Callahan kind of took up the mantle of being our city liaison when Jerry Allen left. And so now we're sort of in that time of transition again. And I know I reached out to Casey Thomas's office, and he had some good suggestions on how we can keep the city partnership going. And so we'll be pursuing that. Also, you know, I think, you know, we're looking at ways to expand the City of Dallas partnership. Jessica Galashaw is here back in the back. She's with the Office of Community Care. And she and I have been talking for the last several months. One of the projects that she's working on is with the Cities for Financial Empowerment, which is a national organization that provides technical assistance for cities that are interested in using their community centers and other city resources to bring financial empowerment centers to the community. And so we've been meeting to figure out what some opportunities could be in that space. And then the last thing is really to continue our efforts to establish more partnerships with the banking industry. I think the great news is we have, as you saw, a really good list of engaged financial institutions, both banks and credit unions. There's also opportunities within the emerging financial technology space. So we have a subcommittee that's been working to help us find but also vet technology product solutions. So when you think about folks, even low-income folks that now have smartphones, how can we make connections there? How can that augment the physical banking presence that happens within these neighborhoods and communities? And so with that, I wanted to again thank the city for their partnership. You know, we've really, I think, accomplished a lot in the last 7 years being able to build out this coalition, and we look forward to future opportunities as well.
So. All right. Thanks, Greg. I want to thank former Councilmember Allen for his work on that, and then Councilman Callahan for your working commitment being a part of this process. Councilmember Atkins.
Thank you, Mayor Thomas. I remember when Jerry started this, I was on the council, read about the payday cash loan. We call FICA, Friendship West, Albach, Concord, and Antioch. Could you tell me a success story? What have you accomplished? You know, I hear the strategy, what you're doing. Tell me a success story from the community, what you've accomplished in the last 7 years.
Yeah, I think the success story is in connecting a lot of these affordable products and services that have really emerged in the last 7 years to community organizations. And so I'll use Concord Church as an example. So we work with Candy Bradshaw with Harmony Community Development Center that's there. So being able to connect with the clients that she works with, who are coming really for social services, right? They're coming for the food bank. And her mantra has always been, you know, but how can we solve, you know, what's that core issue of why people keep coming back? And so she's been really working, you know, with the financial institutions that have been involved to connect people to checking accounts, savings accounts, helping them get connected to credit. And so I think that's really the examples that have happened. So it's really been about as these new products have come about. Another example I would give would be with Catholic Charities Dallas, who are now providing alternative small dollar loans as an alternative to payday lending.
Have you? I see the list of finance institution banks in southern part of Dallas. Have you spoke to the bankers, the loan officers, and said why most of the time that in the past that when you generally go to the banker, you talk to the loan officer, and they can say, okay, I can approve your credit, I cannot approve your credit, mm-hmm. I got to go back to the back office in North Dallas. Mm-hmm. And that's what one big concern. I have a very hard burn heart in my heart that happened in southern part of Dallas. They cannot make a decision on a fast pace. Have the bank or the institution said why?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that we've worked through. And I would say in a couple of cases, they have said why. The issue really
why?
Is...
Why? What is the case why they say they cannot make a decision in the southern part of Dallas? In North Dallas, you go north, and the loan officer can make a decision right away. Why?
So... So I don't know that we've addressed the specific question of like on-site decision making.
Right.
It's more been around the underwriting criteria.
So, Redline.
Well, so I'll give you an example. For example, Opportune that's on the list. They were actually able to disclose to us what their underwriting criteria is, which happens to be not so much credit score at all, but the percent of debt to income. So that's helpful to know, because if you have a client that may not have credit or not a good credit score but has no debt to begin with, that product may be a good alternative. I agree with you that that's a challenge, and that's something certainly I think this roundtable can address.
And I think that is a challenge. If the City Dollar did a partnership with you, and I think that's a hard question, and that's the same question we've been asked ever since 2010 mm-hmm. when we started this, and 7 years later, we still ask the same question. We don't know why.
Yeah.
And that is very, very disturbing to me in the community, because that's the same question. I bank all over the same deals like redlining, and I'm trying to make sure redlining do go away in the City of Dallas. Mm-hmm. And in order to invest in southern part of Dallas, and the institution is not taking concern and educating to do that and do not have a proper loan officer, I mean, I don't think it was a good partnership. And we need to address that.
Yeah,
I mean, Rick, we need to address that. It has not been addressed. And then the last 7 years, it has not been addressed. And I'm very disturbed, because when Jerry and I really work on this with all the payday loans on every corner, you know, we try to redo the zoning, and going down to Austin, the lobbies and stuff like that, it's still sending the people to the cash loan companies to get a high interest rate to roll over and roll over and roll over. And right now, 7 years later, we're still in the same boat, and we don't have answers. So therefore, we need to say a partnership with the City of TC. If they can't answer that question, and we're a partnership, that's a bad partnership, because the same question just cannot be addressed. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to chime in. Obviously, you know, the Community Reinvestment Act, it requires banks all over the country to reinvest in these communities. And I think that's where we need to apply the pressure to those. When these companies or banks come out to do these surveys with real estate brokers and investors and others, then I think that's the point where we can make a real difference there. But clearly, it's risk reward, but they seem to always use different parameters in the Southern Dallas area. And there's, of course, there has been a long history of redlining, and we need to end that if we're ever going to elevate the tax base in Southern Dallas. And that's been one of the reasons I've been working with this group to try to make those kinds of structural differences. And I would also go on to mention that one thing has come out of this.
Still running?
Financial.
You should be stopped, right?
Okay. Financial literacy modules.
You're not staffed, Rick. I'm going to cut you out, you know.
Yeah. All right.
Okay, you're not staffed, so I'm going to cut you out. Hold on. Let me finish. I'm sorry. sorry, Rick, I'm going to cut you out. But the point is, if the banks that were forced to go south, I'm not going to call no names, we know who they are, why have not them reached out to the community, which they're supposed to reach out to the community, and why the City of Dallas not doing a better job to hold them accountable for them to do that, especially with loans or houses, cars, and everything. They're not doing it. And they were forced to move to South Dallas. And that's, of course, you need to go back to the institution. I'm not going to call their names out, but we know who they are.
Yep.
So what would you go back and tell them?
I think it's a question that needs to be addressed on a number of levels.
Right.
I think, to your point, being able to get an answer,
the staff is still running.
At the time.
He's not staff. He's not staff. Is anybody at the staff over there? No staff. Okay, go ahead.
So being able to get an answer at the time of the decision is important, but also being able to know what that answer is. So for the nonprofits that we work with, you know, their big fears, they don't want to send a client to a bank to get, the bank may give an answer,
right,
but if that answer is no, that's not doing anybody any good. We need to know when they go in there that they're almost like pre-qualified to get a yes answer. I just wanted to quickly say, one of the things that we're looking at, I get your point, we need to address that with the financial institutions. I think there's regulatory and other issues that we don't have time.
Okay, we'll go back.
Yeah, but I just wanted to add, I mentioned a minute ago about Catholic Charities Dallas. So they are offering an alternative loan program where the nonprofits, when they send their clients, they do get that answer right then and there. So that's helpful. The way I would say the banks are participating in that is the banks are providing a grant to Catholic Charities to support that loan program. So there's some sort of back ways to get to get there, but I definitely agree with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Sounds like we may have our new council member for the round table, huh? Ms. Gates.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you for the presentation. I just have one question. Are you partnering with those that apply for the earned, at the sites that have opportunities to get the earned income tax credits?
Yes, yes. So they are part of the roundtable as well.
Okay, okay. So, I mean, those would, I would think would be a match for those that are applying for that.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Felder.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel. I met Roy Lopez, 20, 25 years ago? He used to work for the Southern Dallas Development Corporation, and I was a board member. And with that organization, we were able to give loans to several very successful minority-owned businesses. I can think of five. Four out of the five are still in business. All Temps Temporaries, Back as Clean as They Burn Down, that's the one that's not in business anymore. The Dallas Weekly, On Target Supplies and Logistics, and Nogales Produce. Now, Nogales Produce is the largest distributor of produce in the state of Texas, and they came through the Southern Dallas Development Corporation. So we have a blueprint. We already have a blueprint of success. And another component of the Southern Dallas Development Corporation was a microloan program. And so I'm not sure if we're suggesting that we need to start all over again. We have a blueprint. I just don't know why SDDC went away. So, Roy, I hate to put you on the hot seat, but I'm going to put you on the hot seat.
Oh, the mic's not on, Roy.
Is your mic on? The green light on?
Okay. There you go.
That does a lot of similar things. They do micro-lending, but they have expanded their reach beyond the city of Dallas. They do loans and investments across the state of Texas. So in that respect, that has been rolled over.
So what we need, you know, I think this body is we're all elected to represent certain areas of Dallas and the whole city of Dallas. And so we need a component that focuses on the city of Dallas. And so, I would like to push staff. TC's not in the room at this time, but I'll definitely have him to research that and to recreate something that worked. It worked very well.
Councilman, I will say that we do have a robust ecosystem of small business with community development financial institutions. We recently have had Acción Texas come into the market. There is Lyft Fund that is in the market. We have BCL of Texas in the market, all working with those that are not currently working with financial institutions, working to get their credit to where they need to be, but still being able to start their business with financial education along the way. We have People Fund. So there are several community development financial institutions in the southern sector in the city of Dallas that are doing this type of work that you described.
So, okay. So,
and they do participate in the roundtable, by the way.
All right. Now, what I'd like you to tell me is that give me three companies that have been successful with those institutions that you just mentioned, because I gave you five.
Sure. I will have to go back and get back with you on that one.
So, okay. Yeah. That's my point.
Yeah.
If you have a very successful companies that have sustainability, so we're talking over 25 years of the companies that I mentioned, still in business, except one. That's good.
Yeah.
And we had a credit union in South Dallas. How many of you knew that? On Beeman Street. That went away. So these are the things that we need to do in order to be viable and to grow and to address the issues, the underlying issues in the core of the city of Dallas. And so, I hear what you're saying that, you know, I think you ran off about five or six different institutions, but if they're successful, something would come top of mind and say, hey, I can point to five different businesses, three different businesses that have been successful with this blueprint. I'll go back to it. SDDC was a very successful blueprint, and four out of the five are still in business, and they're multi-million dollar operations to this day. Thank you.
Well, that Southern Dallas loan program is being brought back. I think we may even be voting on that next week, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's going to be reconstituted. Is that correct, Michael? The Southern Dallas loan program, I think the People's Fund is being repackaged and brought back. I think it's going to be called the Southern Dallas loan program. So that model will continue in some form.
Right. Thank you very much. Ms. Clayton.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I wanted to follow up on a couple of questions about, I think Mr. Felder kind of mentioned it, about, you know, kind of a market-based economy versus policy-based, you know, policy-based decisions. So as you guys are going through this and you're looking at, you know, debt-to-income ratio being a factor versus necessarily credit versus redlining versus, you know, economic redlining, from a Delta standpoint, you know, from an individual, you know, the person who just has to get a high dollar loan because of the fact that, for whatever reason, or to Mr. Felder's point, a mom-and-pop shop who just needs a loan to be able to get a space. Do you have a sense of what that delta is as far as what's out there in the marketplace that's not being financed today?
Wow, I don't have a specific number, but the need is great. I would just say that, you know? It is one of these, I think, you know, in terms of the roundtable, you know, we're working with, you know, nonprofit organizations that are trying to serve, you know, thousands upon thousands of people that don't, you know, that don't have access to affordable credit, you know. And so part of that is helping them, you know, establish, you know, credit score or improve their credit score. But a lot of it gets to be to the issue of, you know, if somebody's car breaks down or, you know, they have a medical emergency or the hot water heater goes out, how do those folks resolve that? Because if the car breaks down and they don't have money to fix it, and then all of a sudden they lose their job because they can't get to work, you can see the compounding effects that that has. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I have just a hard number, but it's still it's a big issue.
Are there any programs out there that if you're a small business and using the broken down car, instead of having to go to, you know, high forgive me, I'm blanking on the name, but instead having to get a high interest loan, if a employer wanted to do a payday advance for their employee, mm-hmm. and then employee for whatever reason had to quit, medical emergency, car breaks down, can't get to whatever the scenario is, are there any reimbursement programs out in the that the government offers today that would basically pay back the employer? Has that ever been addressed that you know of?
I'm not aware of any reimbursement programs that are employer-based. I know there's some employers that have like an emergency fund where they're either able to grant or loan funds to employees to solve for some of those issues. We have a group of employers right now that we're working with that are interested in doing employee-sponsored loans. So these would be very low-interest loans that, and the premise is the reason they're low interest and low risk is because they get repaid through payroll deduction, so it's a risk mitigation factor. So there's some of those. I think again the challenge is those are happening. It's like pockets of good.
Right.
And so it's figuring out how do you get that to scale. And that's really the ultimate challenge.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly what I wrote down is, I think when Mr. Atkins asked a question about holding, you know, partners in the city accountable, and as a city in getting, because we have all these things and it's all scale of service. And I guess my last question would be, if knowing that a bank who is not, their job is to make money, not to take care of an individual person, just reality. Mm-hmm. What can we, from a policymaking directive as a city, if you could wave your magic wand and say, okay, look, city, you should make policy to do X, Y, and Z, what policy directives can we do? Because we cannot force ABC Bank to loan at a debt-to-income ratio that's lower than their comfort factor. I mean, we're not going to be able to do that. That is a market-based decision and shareholders and all the things go along with that. But from a policymaking standpoint, we cannot throw enough cash at a problem to move the needle. And that's why right. I asked you about the Delta, because if we put $1 million in it, it is not going to move the needle right. in a real substantial way.
Right.
So what can we do to Mr. Atkins' question from an accountability standpoint? He'll be the incoming, you know, liaison to this group, but is there something that we can be doing or that we should be doing in a more substantial way than what we're doing today?
So I'm
trying to. I was just going to jump in. You know, just being in the commercial real estate business, what we've done is had a, pardon me, a piggyback loans. You know, we do that a lot of times with the city, where one bank, a primary bank, may loan 50%, so it's a shared risk mentality. Then there may be another lender who says, I'll take 30% of that, could even add city incentives, you know, maybe 10%, which could be grants or what have you. And then also there's a little bit of equity, you know, contributed, you know, by the actual user, the developer. And those are models that work, I think, the best because of that shared, you're spreading that risk over several different entities. So that way, if there is a foreclosure, a bank says, well, if we foreclose, I'm sure I'll get my 50% back, and I've got a first lien, then there's a second lien and so forth. So your primary bank is always going to take the major share, but they're going to be protected because they have very limited
so
risk.
So we'd be basically a subordinated lien.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
All right. Thank you. And I have one closing question. If you can bring up the slide with the unbanked percent. Oh, you come from round two? Okay. You last.
There you go.
Thank you. Do you have this information broken down by ethnicity?
Let me check. Let me see if that report, and I don't know, does the FC work?
I think out? We did have that broken
yeah,
down.
Yeah. We'll look. There's a whole
okay.
presentation.
Okay, great. If you can find that, just email it
yeah.
to me.
The I think FDIC, every Mr. Mayor, every 10 yeah. years, the FDIC does this unbanked survey.
Okay.
And that's on economicinclusion.gov.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. But we have, there's some slides that that Eloy was able to analyze and break out specific to Dallas.
Right.
So I'll look at that. And I can
okay,
see
and if you can locate that, if you can send it to me.
Yeah.
Mr. Atkins, 1 minute.
Yeah.
Question. Number one, page 4, I just want to make sure that the purpose of this right here is to reduce high entry loan debt, loan option, and debt to household. And Mark, you made a good point about the debt ratio. But is this the purpose of this, what we're trying to do, is to get low interest rate?
Yes.
Is that correct? And so, therefore, we need to look at how we create policy or institution to make sure the rate is below market with nonprofit who do get grants to loan money at low market. There is a nonprofit company out there that if you have a job, they do get money from corporation institution to loan money to buy a new car at a low interest rate. There are institutions out there doing that, Martin, but they have not partnered with you. So there are people out there, but we need to reach out and see how do we follow the purpose, unless we're going to change that purpose to another policy, then we need to rewrite the purpose of this organization.
Right, right. So we have On the Road Lending, which does the auto lending. They're,
right.
they're a partner with us in the round table. And then, again, I'll go back to Catholic Charities, and there's a few others that are doing these alternative loans that are at low interest. I think Catholic Charities, their alternative to payday lending loans are like at 3%. And so, again, you know, there's things out there. It's just the issue is we're serving hundreds, and we need to figure out how do you get to the serving the thousands.
Excellent. Thank you for being here. Thank you for this information. Thank you, Councilman Callahan, for pushing for us to receive this briefing. Mr. Broad, next.
Thank you, Mayor. And as staff transitions up and we trade seating areas, the next briefing item is the proposed amendments to the City of Dallas Comprehensive Housing Policy to adopt a new housing tax credit policy. The Department of Housing and Neighborhood Revitalization will brief the Council on the proposal to amend the Comprehensive Housing Policy. The purpose of the new tax credit policy is to set parameters under which staff will evaluate proposals submitted by developers requesting resolutions of support and no objection from the city. And Council asked us several months ago to review this particular policy to address quite a few issues, and I'm hopeful that today's presentation will do that and give Council an opportunity to ask the questions necessary. And so with that, I will turn it over to the Director of Housing, David Noguera, who will introduce the other members at the table, as well as begin the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. City Manager. David Noguera, Director of Housing and Neighborhood Revitalization. And before I get started, I just wanted to take a moment to look at how we ended up here. Back in October 24th of last year, the City Council had asked us to come back and develop a low-income housing tax credit policy that reflected the intent and goals of the Comprehensive Housing Policy. And some of the key factors that you asked us to look at were, number one, you wanted a balance between the federal and state requirements with developer and community demands. You wanted an expedited process on how projects could meet city priorities. And you wanted us to push the innovation card, right, looking at how we leverage all local resources and available support for high-quality projects. This morning's recommendation, I believe, meets those factors. Incorporates our listening tours, our technical verification with experts, and the local resources available to support and most importantly, it preserves the It helps us produce and preserve housing units at no additional cost to the city, right? Today we have with us Maureen Milligan, Assistant Director with Housing, who's going to walk us through the briefing, as well as Avis Shoshan, Assistant Director of Housing, will provide technical expertise as needed, and Valerie Williams, Vice President of Community Banking with Bank of America, and she also serves on our Housing Policy Task Force. And over the last several months, Valerie and Maureen have kind of shepherded the building process of the policy that we're presenting today. So with that, let me turn it over to Maureen.
Good morning. So we'll go through a little bit of background on housing tax credits, then how we made our recommendations, or how we developed our recommendations for an amendment to the Comprehensive Housing Policy, and then provide an overview of what that amendment is. So as you've heard on a number of occasions, your role as a city council is you can adopt a resolution of support or no objection for a housing tax credit project, and both for 9% housing tax credit projects and 4% housing tax credit projects. Those resolutions are very important for them, at least 9%, to be competitive at the state level, and it's just a threshold item for a 4% housing tax credit project. And so our housing policy currently contains a policy related to how staff make determinations of when to recommend a tax credit project for a resolution. And today we're proposing a number of changes to that policy based on direction that you gave us in October when we initially proposed a amendment to the Comprehensive Housing Policy related to tax credit projects. So just a little bit of overview of tax credits. Again, this is one of the primary means of incentivizing private investment in affordable housing projects. And so a developer who's awarded an allocation of tax credits sells those. Often enough, it's banks that are looking to satisfy some of their Community Reinvestment Act responsibilities, and they become an equity investor in the project. And so this is a primary means of getting funding for affordable housing projects that are not coming from local jurisdictions. And we'll be talking a lot about 4% and 9% projects. And again, really the two things to focus on is that a 9% project at the state level goes through a competitive scoring process. And those projects are competitive because, as you can see, the value of the tax credits that are awarded to a 9% project provides a lot more opportunity for equity in the project than a 4% project. 9% projects tend to be almost exclusively new construction. 4% projects can be new construction, but are often our rehab projects. So really briefly, just to give you an overview of how we developed this proposed amendment to the housing policy, one of the directives that you gave us in October was to consult with HUD. We did consult with HUD about a number of issues, especially related to fair housing. If you remember, one of the issues related to the housing tax credit projects that we brought before you in October was related to whether they passed a fair housing review. We'll talk about that later in the presentation, but that was one of our main things that we talked about with HUD. Then we brought in a tax credit expert out of Austin, Diana McIver, who gave a training to about 50 individuals about Tax Credit 101, just so really any member of the public who is interested in learning about tax credits could go through this free training. Then we really delved deeply into tax credits. Valerie, leading our Neighborhood Quality of Life Committee, subcommittee, part of the Housing Task Force. We spent a number of meetings starting from the ground up, looking at the existing policy, looking at what other jurisdictions in Texas are doing, and then sitting down and talking about what we think the city's priority should be in terms of supporting housing tax credit projects. We then brought in TDA Consulting that helped us look at our proposed policy and compared it to the Qualified Allocation Plan, the QAP, which is how the state scores projects, and then broke into a smaller working group with individuals who are interested in really refining the policy. And we consulted with TDHCA, the state agency responsible for allocating housing tax credits, just to ensure we weren't developing a policy that was not in alignment with some of their procedures. And now we're before you today. So again, we engaged in a lot of outreach. We just wanted to highlight quickly for you to show you the different types of organizations and individuals that participate in this process, including advocacy groups, the development community, public agencies, as well as other departments within the city of Dallas and industry experts. And so this here is just to show you some of the groups that participated, including our industry experts, public agencies, and we were very grateful for a number of other departments that participated and provided great feedback in the development of this process or this policy, as well as both for-profit and nonprofit builders. So three areas that you were concerned about that we really focused on was timing. So how often should we solicit and review proposals for housing tax credit projects, as well as can we develop some more specific criteria so that a developer understands when am I likely to get a staff recommendation, when am I likely to pass a fair housing review? And then again, when we're talking about fair housing, what are the things that we're going to be looking at? And so we'll first talk about timing. The first recommendation that we're bringing forward to you is to go from a once-a-year process to a quarterly process. Now, for 9% tax credits, the state only scores them once a year, and so for 9% tax credits, they're only projects they'll only apply once a year. But for 4% tax credit projects, as long as their request aligns with the meeting of the TDHCA board, they can apply for an allocation of 4% tax credits throughout the year. While we didn't feel comfortable recommending a rolling application process, just looking at staff capabilities. We are recommending 4 times a year, and this was, like any good negotiation, something that both sides were maybe not entirely happy with, but this is the recommendation that came out of the task force for a quarterly review. So this is to help you understand the different levels of review that different types of projects will go through. So every project, whether you're a 4% project or a 9% project, will have to meet specific threshold items. And we have 2 pages of threshold items that any project would have to meet. If you don't meet all of those threshold items, you would not receive a staff recommendation. You as a council would not even see the project. A 4% project only needs a resolution of no objection from the city council, and again, those are not the competitively scored projects. So if they pass all of the threshold items, then staff would bring forward a recommendation that you provide a resolution of no objection. For those competitive 9% projects, there are 2 means by which they could get a staff recommendation. One is we developed 6 proposed city priorities that if your project can meet threshold and meets one of those 6 city priorities, then you would be eligible for a staff recommendation. If for some reason your project doesn't meet one of those 6 priorities, but it's still a strong project, we do have a scoring system that you can go through where really a combination, if you're able to put together a combination of factors, you could be eligible. So again, that threshold is to establish that baseline. And in the next 2 slides, I'm not going to go through every element, but I will discuss the things that seem to be of most concern when we talked with you in October about tax credit projects. So one thing was to make sure that we're aligning with state standards. So you'll see a number of criteria that just make sure that the project is really fully ready to be submitted to the state. We don't need to be wasting our time on projects that are still under development. And you'll see also item 6 that we clearly state that every project is subject to a fair housing review. So that was something that wasn't as clearly stated in the prior policy. Another thing that really came out of the task force as well as guidance from you in October is considering tenants that are living in projects that are being rehabbed or maybe that are in a project that's not tax credit that's going to be repositioned into a tax credit project is making sure those tenants are really aware of what's happening. And so as a threshold item, the developer would be required to provide notice to tenants. And if the Uniform Relocation Act for some reason doesn't apply to their project, they would have to submit a relocation plan that deals with both any permanent displacement as well as any temporary displacement. We heard stories of elderly and disabled tenants who were living in tax credit projects that were being required to leave their units for the majority of the day. That was very disruptive to them, and so the city would be looking at a relocation plan and would be approving that relocation plan before a project would be eligible for a staff recommendation. And then both items 9 and 12 address the concerns that you addressed about quote-unquote Band-Aid rehabs. And so I see Mr. Kleinman nodding. This is something that was not required before. A rehab project would have to submit both a plan and cost review as well as a capital needs assessment. So the plan and cost review is going to look at whether the construction costs are reasonable, whether they're timed out so that the project can be completed in the time frame that is proposed, and whether the plans align with the building standards. The capital needs assessment really looks at the existing needs of the property, what needs to be rehabbed to bring the property up to current standards, and then what funds need to be reserved so that the property can be maintained during its useful life. And so what staff would propose to do is we would review this capital needs assessment. We would send a housing inspector out to the property to confirm that those photos that you're showing us and the issues you're indicating are at the property are the issues that are at the property and that there aren't any others. And then we would attach a summary of that to the resolution so that everyone's on the same page as to what the developer was proposing to do to the property. Once a project passes threshold, again for a 4% project, they would be eligible for a resolution of support. A 9% project would have to go through another layer of review. And so these are the 6 city priorities that we're proposing. Two of them you can see are, if the city's investing in the project already, we've underwritten it, we've taken a look at it, we feel strongly enough about it that we're providing funding to the project, we think that should essentially be a city priority. Also, if our partners at the Housing Authority have elected to go through a competitive HUD program and they've been awarded funding under that program, we are proposing that that's also a city priority. One of the goals of the housing policy is to ensure that we are providing affordable housing throughout the city of Dallas. And so if a developer, we encourage developers to find sites that are in low poverty census tracts, and if they do, that would be a city priority, as well as our reinvestment strategy areas that you've already determined are a city housing priority. And then finally, looking at how we can help our Office of Homeless Solutions and address families that are experiencing homelessness. If the developer is willing to enter into a MOU with the Continuum of Care lead provider to accept referrals for the project for 20% of the units, that would also be a city priority. This is not related to permanent supportive housing, but this would be looking at individuals that are experiencing those economic homelessness that need to find housing but don't necessarily need the wraparound services that you might need in permanent supportive housing. If for some reason your project doesn't hit one of these city priorities, we are proposing an additional means by which you could get a resolution, a staff recommendation for a resolution. So out of a total of 75 points, you would have to score 50 points. And you could combine any of these four criteria. So we really discussed a lot in the task force about how to facilitate mixed income projects. It can be very difficult to do within the tax credit world, but if you're able to do it and you're able to find other funding for your project that doesn't involve the tax credit equity, then you could get a maximum of 20 points, which is a lot related to that 50. If you just have to hit a 50 minimum score, we certainly are continuing to want to support our nonprofit and hub businesses that might partner in a development, looking at how can we really direct sites to be in areas where there's access to amenities, as well as making sure that there are services that are provided on site. Like we did with our land bank program, we are working very closely with our Office of Equity and Human Rights to address fair housing concerns and to try to really bake in a fair housing review into the process. And so we believe we've done that in three ways. So one is that, again, we're prioritizing projects in low poverty areas. If you're in a high poverty area, one of the threshold items is that you have to provide a significantly higher number of services on site. So essentially, if the neighborhood itself isn't providing the amenities, you have to provide the amenities on site. Also, targeting special needs populations such as our homeless community. We are very clearly now stating in this proposed policy that a 9% project can get an extra point if they have a minimal city commitment of funding. So we want this to be automatic for 9% projects. And we have placed this on your voting agenda for June 12th. And we are here for any questions.
All right. First, I want to commend Michael, David, Maureen, Avis, the whole team. We got briefed on this in the Economic Development Housing Committee meeting. The fact that you engage CHOTOs, you engage, you know, other organizations that are providing, doing housing for in the city of Dallas, I think it's made a tremendous difference. The input that they gave, we can see that, and the fact that this, which was a major, major issue and concern, you took the time, did the due diligence, and came back with something that I think that we can all live with and potentially be supportive of. Ms. Atkins.
Thank you, Mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, TC, and thank you for your staff. You said 5 months you're going to come back. I guess this is part of housing policies. There will be some more amendment coming down the road, so let's make sure we have finished the project. I didn't see the MVA in there pertaining to 4%, because I know last time we had a two project with 4%, and they said, well, it's not in the MVA. Could you kind of talk about why you did not say anything about MVA with 4% tax credit?
So, Mr. Atkins, one of the city priorities will be reinvestment strategy areas that were developed after the MVA, after an analysis of the MVA. And so that still is in the policy that if you hit, you can hit a city priority by being located in a reinvestment strategy area. But based on some of the feedback that we got from you, we acknowledge that not all of the projects that may need a rehab are located in those reinvestment strategy areas. So as opposed to the prior policy that made that a scoring criteria, we've removed and almost a required element, we've removed that element and made it one of six priorities. But for any project we would bring forward for a staff recommendation, we would provide maps like we do to show you what MBA category it's listed in.
And I think that's something we need to show before the 12th so we understand that everything we do under the city manager said we always look at MBA. So with a map, and we definitely need to bring that back up and look at the 4% MBA. Another question is, number one, that a 4%, we just do a resolution to the state and say this is a resolution only. Go back to Mr. Kleinman's concern is, how do we make sure that the city is doing their job before a 4% is applied, a request for a resolution for the city of Dallas? For example, we do have some apartment 15 years old or 20 years old. We supposed to do our job to inspect, to make sure the code, make sure everything's done. Then for our housing, they go in and do their job. But then, too, when the developer goes down there and do the resolution, how do we make sure they live up to their expectation what we did, our job, on the front end?
So a number of things. Certainly our code compliance department, we will continue to find ways to work more closely with them as we identify projects that are already existing tax credit projects to make sure that code compliance is inspecting those on a regular basis so that we don't get to the point where we're talking about a Band-Aid rehab or significant deferred maintenance issues because we're always looking at those projects. But you're correct. The developer will be within this proposed policy, giving us a capital needs assessment and showing us how they have evaluated the needs of the property and how they plan to fix those needs, and we will go out to the property to confirm that those are the needs that need to be fixed. And if there's a disagreement, that disagreement would have to be resolved before staff would make a recommendation that they be eligible for a council resolution.
I do understand that. Do that need a condition? Do that follow with a resolution to the state? Because we cannot demand them to do that to make sure they do the improvements. So how do we cannot assure, unless we got a deed restriction, we don't have deeds in that policy of 4%. How do we make sure that developer is a great developer? I'm going back to Mr. Kleinman always saying, hey, you put a Band-Aid on these apartments, they keep it 15 years, and all of a sudden we got a problem. I know we can't put no teeth in it, but how do we make sure that developer with Cole, who go inspect the apartments before we do the resolution, there is a documentation, there is a resolution that is said this is what they're going to do if they go down to the state to apply for the 4%. If they do not do that, there is a documentation that said, hey, you say you're going to do this, why are you not doing that? How do we follow that up, and how can we make sure that is in the resolution? I know legally we got no teeth in it, but I want to make sure that is in a resolution on all 4%. How do we do that?
So we will include the summary of the capital needs assessment in the resolution, but I want to let Valerie Williams weigh in because her input as a banker and helping us understand the due diligence that the lender is also going to do related to the property was also very helpful as we were bringing our recommendations forward.
Thank you. Banks will take the information that is given in the capital needs assessment and utilize that in financing. So if the developer tells us they're going to do something, we are monitoring that on a regular basis regarding them getting the loan in order to do the work. The sources and uses of funds will include the cost of that work and money allocated specifically to meet the needs in the capital assessment. If they do not do what they tell us they're going to do, then they're in violation of loan documents and we can take whatever necessary action we need to take. But we do hire consultants that represent the bank to make sure that work is being completed.
is that information transferred back to the city? Do they keep within the bank in the state?
If the city is providing any kind of financing, it would be
only if the city,
right.
Not
but
because of revolution.
But also with TDHCA, they do get a copy of it also.
So do the city get a copy of it?
If that's what the city
requires. That's what I'm asking.
We're not allowed.
I know you do not. Right. I just want to make sure that, you know, I'm still going back to Mr. Kleinman and what I hear in the committee. We want to be up to date what's going on with all 4%. We want to make sure, is that developer doing what he's saying he's going to do? If he's not doing it, we want to know that he's not doing that project. He's not doing the repairs because we got to go back and gave a resolution for the 4%, and once we get a resolution, they didn't do their job. So we don't need to, if he come back up again to do another 4%, hey, you're the bad actor. You just didn't do this. Now we got some records that said you didn't do your job, and plus you was in default because of your loan, because this is what you said you're going to do anyway.
Right.
And that's what happened. And when the code get to it, and the code to inspection, and we find out, well, we don't know what they're supposed to do or what they didn't supposed to do.
Councilmember Atkins, so one of the things that we will be doing moving forward, particularly under the next council, is providing regular updates on projects that that council has supported either through resolution or through funding, so that you know how those assets are performing. To the extent that there are issues, we'll inform you of those issues. But I do want to make the distinction between those that we provide financial support with and those that we do not, because we have fewer teeth involved in those deals.
Well, you're referring just to 4%, right?
I'm referring to the ones that we're not providing financial assistance to.
Which one is those?
So the ones that receive a letter of a resolution of no objection. Excuse me. The project, whether it's receiving a 4%, 9%, a letter of no objection, or a letter of support. The key issue is whether we're providing financial assistance to the project.
I think that what we should do, if we're not putting financial assistance or whatever, is still our responsibility as a city with our code to check and make sure everything is up to code before it go down the road. And I think that's our job, and that's what we should do, to monitor all property in all apartments. That's what we're having right now, and that's why we had this big discussion to rewrite this policy, because we're not doing a great job monitoring those apartments. We just had a speaker here today. There's a project we got, and talking about infested with roaches and rats and everything else, and it's not our project, but it's still in the city of Dallas, and we got citizens who live in there. So, therefore, those conditions that should be there in the first place. So that's my concern. So
yeah.
We should monitor everything. Page 14. Do we have any application applied in 4% between April 12th and May? Is anything in there? I know it's May is over with. Do we have anybody apply for 4%?
You haven't amended the policy, so right now we're operating on a once-a-year policy. So the amendment would have to be voted on before we would go over to that.
So after June 12th, is there anybody in the queue for 4% for July and August? Do we have some people who waiting on right now that's saying, hey, when we pass this, I'm hoping to apply for 4%?
Right now, we don't have any because all of the prior 4%, oh, I'm sorry, Ava Shoshan, Assistant Director of Housing Neighborhood Revitalization, all the prior 4% were passed at the February meeting, at a meeting in February. So they have already received the resolutions of no objection. So we don't have any in the pipeline right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Atkins. Ms. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I was looking at the minutes of the October 24th meeting, and there were five conditions that were placed on the deferral. Condition number one is recommendations regarding how to identify and evaluate rehabilitation of properties and to determine whether the rehabilitation affirmatively furthers fair housing. I'm having a little bit of trouble seeing that answered in this presentation. Can you help me with that a little?
So there's two separate factors, right? Number one, as part of our threshold items, all of the proposals that come before you will receive a fair housing assessment, right? And we're explicitly laying
Can I stop you on that point just real quickly, Mr. Nogueira? Will that be the same kind of fair housing assessment that we apply to all other housing projects, or TDHCA LIHTC projects subject to a different fair housing review?
No, the same federal requirement applies to all of these projects.
Okay. That is a good thing, because I think that was a question back in October. TDHCA has not caught up to the feds in terms of its requirements, but we're still subject to the federal requirements. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the way this came up is we had these two projects that were not ever going to pass fair housing review. And the point of having a policy is to prevent the ad hoc approval of projects that don't meet policy. What I want from staff is a policy that prevents projects that won't pass fair housing review or may not pass fair housing review from getting to us. Is this going to do that?
Yes.
Okay.
So the fair housing factor is addressed in the threshold. If the proposal doesn't pass threshold, we're done.
Okay.
You won't see it.
This is good, Mr. Nogueira. That's reassuring. So I have a property that I want to rehabilitate using LIHTC. I fill out an application with TDHCA. I have to fill out an application with the city also. I see Ms. Chison nodding her head yes. You guys are going to do a staff review, put it through fair housing process, and if it doesn't meet fair housing review, we're never going to see it.
Correct.
Mr. Atkins committee won't even be bothered with it.
Correct.
Okay, that's good. Is it possible using the MVA to draw lines on the map of the city to indicate to developers and to us policymakers where it is and is not currently legally possible to deploy tax credits? Because I think that would be a very useful map.
So I think there's some guidance that we can give. We certainly, and we shared this in the task force of where all of the 20% and below poverty census tracts were. That fair housing review is really on a case-by-case basis. And so if you go back to the threshold items, one thing that we struggled with within the task force was how to address existing projects that were in specifically recaps that were in need of repair. And how do we address that concern of...
That's the specific question we asked, Ms. Milligan, and that's what's not answered in here, because there are projects in recaps that literally are not legally subject to the use of tax credits. And we need to be honest with people about that. We need to not waste people's time thinking that they are able to rehabilitate a project that's in an area of deep poverty that doesn't have access to the amenities that you list in number three on the scoring criteria, that doesn't have currently the services offered in four, that's not going to be a mixed income project subject to the scoring in number one. I think we need to be more honest in identifying the projects that must be rehabilitated using market money. Because I know that this is uncomfortable. I know that what we're struggling with is people in need. Some of these people in need need other kinds of services than LIHTC. They need us to come in and help them in a different way. And as Inclusive Communities Project has pointed out to us, in some cases, as bad as we don't like it, as much as we hate this idea, there are people who need mobility to address their housing problems. And I mean, they may need a new place to live. So that's the only slide 24 is the only thing that really has got me worried. require projects in high poverty areas to demonstrate significant commitment to services and amenities. I am struggling to see how a LIHTC project in a high poverty area is ever going to pass fair housing review. Tell me and challenge me on that. Tell me where I'm wrong.
So one of the key factors I want you to consider, though, is the fact that fair housing is a review that we do on a citywide basis. And one of the shortcomings I think we've had in recent history is that we are scrutinizing each and every project separately and expecting that project to represent the city's standard for fair housing, right? When the standard should be spread across the city. Now this tool, this low-income housing tax credit policy tool that we created is not the only tool that we have in our box to support those dilapidated apartment complexes that you've been speaking to, right? It will help us address many. And our objective was to push the limits on what this tool could do, again, with no money from the city. At the same time, to the extent that we have projects that the city would like to address, we will have to utilize some of our other tools, whether it be our direct financing that's available, some of our tax incentives. That's where we're going to have to get a little bit more creative. But what I want to caution you from doing is from looking at any one of the tools that we bring before you and expect it to be the silver bullet for all of our affordable housing needs and issues citywide.
In fact, I've got the opposite opinion, Mr. Noguera. I think that we are fooling ourselves about the utility of tax credits in certain areas of the city. And I think we should be able to draw a map to show where tax credits can and cannot be used. So anyway, I appreciate y'all's work on this. I know that this was 6 months of hard work, and I can see the engagement that you did. So consider me mostly reassured. And if you bring forward projects that are really good, I'm going to cheer for you. And if a bad one happens to weasel its way through to council, then I'll be asking you why the policy didn't work. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You're welcome. Ms. Cronin.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. With regards to Mr. Kingston's question about maps, I mean, simply looking at the recap should be a good indicator, I think, to a lot of developers about fair housing. Would it not? I mean, shouldn't that not just be part of the deal? Look at these maps. These are not areas we can do this.
So one thing we took into consideration, or two things we took into consideration, was if you are developing in a high poverty census tract above 40% poverty, you have to bring those amenities on site, as well as the rehab has to be a good rehab. So having been in a number of these projects where things go wrong is it's usually a combination of there's no services on site for the families to take advantage of, and they're living in very terrible conditions. That being said, even if you hit those 2 points, so you're agreeing that you're going to provide extra amenities, you're doing a good rehab based on our assessment, it still does have to pass a fair housing review. So if we think back to, for example, the projects that we looked at in October, one of the concerns that ICP has was the level of violent crime in the neighborhood. So we certainly, that meeting those two components is not going to get you past a fair housing review. It still will look at other factors, but that's where I couldn't answer Mr. Kingston's question to say that there's a prohibition of supporting a rehab and a recap. It would be on a case-by-case basis.
So I just think his point is, and I would agree, is let's not lead potential developers on. And they should know there's a pretty high bar to do that in a recap area. And we prefer that they focus in the other areas, and that's the main thing, is that they really understand that.
Absolutely, and that's why setting the thresholds and the priorities was our attempt to show developers, here's where the city's drawn the line. Start looking at projects that meet these priorities, and don't bring a project that isn't going to meet them.
Okay, great. Also, I do very much appreciate the thresholds that you added in to address some of the rehabilitation issues that I have concerns with, Mr. Atkins has concerns with. I wish there were somehow to have maybe longer term teeth in that besides just code compliance. Is there any chance we could require an escrow or a sinking fund, or that they maintain something over the period of time that they're also required to have their, I guess, their LURA or whatever it is, their deed restriction?
We haven't proposed that as part of the policy, but I think one of the benefits, again, of having Valerie at the table is understanding where the levers are in this process. And since we're going to be very familiar with all of these projects, if after the resolution is provided and the project is not being rehabbed, we have the ability to go to the lender who may have that lever even if we don't.
No, I understand that if they're not delivering the project within the time frame of delivering the project. But my concern is the long-term maintenance. And so I think you've done good, right, with the lenders, because the lenders are going to say you have to do these things to get this money. A lot of the lenders work on a draw basis anyhow, so they wouldn't even get air conditioning money unless they put the air conditioning in. But then what happens in years 2, 3, 4, you know, at a 15 or 20-year deed restriction, how do we make sure that they maintain that stuff long-term? And can we – I guess the first question is legally under the HUD and LIHTC rules and all that, could we require a sinking fund or an escrow for that? And because that's a kind of simple question, we have to go back and research, can we even do that? But if we can do that, what would be involved in it? I think it's worth considering.
Just so you know, with LIHTC financing, there are various capital reserves and also replacement reserves that are required by the investors that are purchasing the LIHTC credits.
Okay, so the reserves, those reserves are in place when they buy the credits.
Right, and there is also periodic compliance that TDHCA does. To make sure that the property is still in good standing and operational. If they find problems at a property and those issues are not resolved in a timely manner, a developer could be prohibited from participating in the program for either 1 to 2 years.
But there are no prohibitions for the developer has to own the property during the period, do they?
Well, but you have the investor that's still in it.
Okay.
The investor controls, they own 99.9% mm-hmm. of the property. So they control a lot.
I just want to be comfortable that those reserves are in place and that someone's monitoring it and mm-hmm. all that kind of thing. Because I appreciate very much that TDHCA can come in after the fact if people aren't meeting the criteria. But the reality is we have lots of those properties in Dallas uh-huh. right now. So something fell apart in that compliance piece. Now, I feel more comfortable that our housing department, our new and improved housing department, will raise the alert sooner than later. But also, that means that they have to be cooperating with TDHCA. And if we have a problem, call them in sooner than later, as opposed to looking the other way. Because Ms. Williams, you haven't been here to hear me rant about how I just really don't like these rehabs at all. I'd really much rather see us build new properties. But if we can put the guardrails around them that they do this, the needs assessment, the capital needs assessment, and then they put the stuff in, and then there's reserves to make sure it's maintained long term, then at the end of that period, we end up with a reasonably decent property and not something that just has been extorted for rents and never reinvested in. And that's important to Housing in Dallas. So I think we're getting there and getting close there. With regards to the disconnect between some of the TDHCA policies and the HUD policies, I mean, we do have the ability to influence the QAP. We really need to be down there working with them and getting them lined up. You know, we're a big city with a lot of housing. They'll listen to us. I'm sure they will. So please do that. This was interesting. I hadn't really thought about it along the way. I probably should have asked it back in the Housing Committee way back. Do we charge an application fee to the developer?
We do not.
Why not? I mean, there's a lot of work you guys are doing here.
There's a lot of work. I also have a high expectation. Those 20,000 units that you're expecting, I don't have the funding. This department does not have the funding to secure it. So I am looking under every COFR available to me to establish new units and preserve existing units. So if that means that we can bring on an additional 300 units by our staff taking the time to review a proposal, then I think that's staff time well spent.
But the developers, I mean, especially in these tax credit programs, they stand to make a lot of money on these projects, a lot. And the developer fees are huge. That's what's always bothered me about these is they're pulling a lot of money out of the project just to get it established, set it up so that it can get tax credits, and then provide it and sell the tax credit paper. I mean, I really think we ought to think about establishing a fee on this, evaluating what it takes to take a project from the day the developer asks the first question to the day the tax credit is issued, and then if we have compliance stuff beyond that. So it's quite and honestly, Mr. Noguera, I mean, if we're saying we're afraid that's going to discourage some developers, well, the kind of developers going to discourage is probably not the developer we want. If it's a developer that's trying to bring in 3 units, 5 units, you know, a developer that's trying to bring in 100 units, a fee like that relative to their overall development fee is minuscule. So I think you should consider that. Go ahead.
Well, so I was just going to say that the cost of preparing a proposal is substantial. And part of what we're hoping to achieve with this policy is to inform developers as to what the expectations are before they even waste the time and financial resources. My expectation is that the more we educate, the more we work with developers who are bringing proposals forward before they even submit an application, the easier it's going to be for us to complete our evaluation. We should not be seeing a proposal for the first time when they submit it. We should, as Mr. Atkins asked earlier, do we know who's coming forward? Well, we'll be in communication with them. I think many of the potential developers are listening to today's briefing to see just where we're going with this, right? What is the city's position going to be?
I appreciate that.
Excuse me, Mr. Cloudman, you time.
One question. If y'all would follow up.
Sure, respond.
Can we just do an analysis of the cost of city time and resources to evaluate one of these from beginning to end? Just what's it going to cost?
Yes.
Thank you,
Mr. Kleiman. Mr. Felder, round one.
All right. So the fact that we are 20,000 units short of affordable housing, just want to speak to the point of building new construction. So if you take offline an entire apartment complex or two, you could be displacing 250 to 500 people. And so I think during our conversation, we addressed the concern that Mr. Kleiman has with regard to the appliances and to the upgrading of the apartments. And I suggested there's another way around that, and that is, you know, because basically when developers go in, they use FHA-grade carpeting, paint, appliances. Upgrade the appliances that give you more warranty. Upgrade the carpeting that is above FHA grade, and maybe take the time frame down from 30 years to 20 years or 25 years. And I think you solve that, and you also save displacement of people for a long term from having to move for a year to maybe having to move for 30 days to 60 days. And so I'd like to hear your comments with regard to that.
So one of the things I want to stress is the importance of this capital needs assessment, right? Because as Maureen spoke before about Band-Aid rehabs, right, this is the criteria we're going to use to prevent any proposals that have minimal repairs from coming before you,
okay,
right? In terms of changes in the timeline of the LORA, I don't know if you can speak about that, but I know there are certain requirements that the state has on what those are, right? So I don't think we can play with that.
So that would be a statutory change to the regulations to change the requirements for the LURA to be less than the 35 years to 20 years. So we would have to work, like Mr. Kleinman said, to with our legislator to on the next round legislative session to make that change.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but let's still talk about the upgrade of the appliances. Let's talk about that.
So that would be addressed through the capital needs assessment. To the extent that new appliances are needed, that would be indicated there.
In terms of the quality and the type of appliance, you know, because you can get the basic entry level grade of dishwasher and range, but then you can get a higher grade that is going to last longer, which has a longer warranty. So that's where I'm going with that.
So TDHCA governs some of that in terms of the whether they're Energy Star rated appliances and things like that. We don't specifically set a threshold within this item of the type of appliances that are required.
I mean, but is that something that we can consider?
Something certainly you as policymakers could consider if there is a proposed amendment to this threshold criteria.
And I'd like to make that proposal. And the second piece was with regard to relocation. Mr. Kleinman mentioned the fact that, you know, he would like to see a new construction versus rehab. And so, again, we're at a critical stage in affordable housing and taking those units offline and taking those, displacing those people for up to a year, it just adds to the problem. So can you speak to that as opposed to new construction, rehab versus new construction with that in mind?
We're bringing forward a policy that seeks to incentivize both types of projects. So new construction, which generally is anticipated as being on underutilized land, as well as rehabs. In general, when we talk to developers, it is a lot of loss in rent if they take a entire complex offline. And so what we heard is generally these rehabs are building by building. And so that's why we added in the relocation provisions, because when tenants really are affected, it tends to be that temporary displacement when they're just being told, go to this unit. Maybe this unit isn't in good condition because they're rehabbing their existing unit, or they're told you can't be in your unit for 12 hours out of the day. So we are attempting to address those disruptions to the families' lives.
And let's go into relocation a little bit more. What sort of relocation policy in terms of what we're going to give for people that have to relocate?
So the proposal right now, if there is permanent displacement, requires the relocation plan to align with the URA, which may include payment for tenants who are permanently displaced. This wouldn't be coming out of the city's pocket. It wouldn't be a city-initiated relocation, but the developer would have to plan for that cost.
Right. So all I'm trying to do is delve a little bit deeper into see what the developer is going to be required to pay for the relocation cost.
It really depends on the terms of the tenant's lease and the type of displacement. So it's an individual evaluation of the tenant.
But I think the key factor is, if you look at number 8 here, we will be requiring them to submit a plan to us should any tenants be relocated through the project. Mm-hmm. So before when we bring a proposal before the council, mm-hmm. we'll lay out what that plan is on the project to address your questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Atkins, round 2.
I guess, can I have Beverly come to the mic, please, in front of housing? Is she here? And go to page 24. I'm kind of prep this. Bullet 2, high poverty areas demonstrated significant commitment to serve amenity. The two projects we had 5 or 6 months ago, my concern is, number 1, that if we are in a high poverty area, Are we saying with this new policy we're going to forget about that? There's no way that we can improve, invest in a high poverty area? I know that when we wrote the housing policy said that it did not pass for our housing. And the policy was already written. But I did hear Fair Housing said there could be some amenities, something you could have done, that it would have passed Fair Housing. So what could have you done that it could have passed Fair Housing 5 to 6 months ago? Because we already had the policy already made. So I want to get some clarification on that.
Okay, Councilmember Atkins, are you speaking specifically to the past project?
Yes, ma'am.
I think that particular project presented a unique set of challenges in history that made it very difficult to overcome those particular problems with that project. So I think for a project like that to pass a fair housing review, they would have had to do something truly transformational.
Like what?
I think it's one of those things where it's hard to say exactly if you do A, B, and C, but we would have had to see a significant proposal that would have presented opportunities for people to have access to certain things that they don't have in that community right now. You know, whether it be, you know, it could be jobs programs, training, some type of support systems put in place that would give it an indication that there was truly an investment, not only being made in the property, but in the people that live in that community. And so I think going forward, one of the things that we talked about in terms of developing this new policy is making sure that people understand ahead of time that when they approach us with projects, they need to understand our expectations about the types of projects that we would approve. And so that's why we worked collaboratively in developing these new policies, so there would be no confusion for people who bring projects to the table.
Thank you. I thought that was a great explanation. It's number one that I do not want no part of the city with a high poverty area that just disappeared off the map. Because we got to look at, even though the NBA said, you know, is there no color over there, do they have to wait? No, I don't think they have to wait. I think that we need to carve our policy to the point how do we do make improvement, you know, job training, transportation, whatever amenity we need in order to grow the tax base. And we keep hearing that 14% of the tax base is south, 85% north, and we all hear equality. And I hear some colleagues say, hey, you know, I may live in the north. I don't want to give 25% to the south, but we should be balanced. And I don't want to hear that because we need to balance the city and to grow our property tax and to have a better quality of life. And these things right here in high poverty area, we got to look at. How do we develop a high poverty area? How do we train the citizen over there? We got jobs right now at Redbury. We got 500 jobs over there. Can they be trained to make sure in a high poverty area that they have transportation to get to those jobs? The inland port. We got all those things that we need to make sure do not lose focus on a high poverty area. We cannot lose focus on there. And I'm trying to make sure when we do make this policy, do not lose focus. If we put the map, as Mr. Clement said, this is a high poverty area. It's a challenge, you know. We do have investors who go into high poverty area to invest their money. It's an opportunity in the long run to make more money, but we cannot leave that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Thank you for this presentation. It is now 11:20. What we're going to do is we'll take C and D after our recess. So it's not 11:21. And we'll be in recess, and we'll return at 1 o'clock.
All right, it's now 1:12 and we have a quorum. Before we get started, today is a special day. Today we're going to recognize one of our colleagues, Mr. Lee Kleinman. May 10th, I believe, was a special day for you. And so we have something for you. And so we're going to take a moment and if you would, lead us. And we're not going to say happy belated birthday. We're going to say happy birthday. So if you lead us with.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Bruce Lee. Happy birthday to you.
All right. We're going to resume. We're going to begin with our presentation or this afternoon, which is C. And we'll turn it over to Mr. Broadnax.
Thank you, Mayor. State law mandates that the public retirement systems with over $100 million in assets are audited by an independent actuary every 5 years. The city contracted with Deloitte to perform these audits for the Dallas Employees Retirement Fund and the Dallas Police and Fire Pension System. Jenny Chen with Deloitte Actuary, who led the audit, is here to give us the presentation of those results. I don't know if I'll turn it over directly to Mr. Chen or to our Chief Financial Officer, but I'll turn it over to Elizabeth.
Thank you. I'll start. Just to say, this is one of the things that we committed to do with our pension systems, was to exercise more oversight to make sure that we were attuned to what was happening in our pension system. So there is a state law requirement. However, we go above and beyond state law in that we do activities every year to ensure that we are properly overseeing the pension funds for our employees. So I want to thank Jeannie and her team at Deloitte. They have been our actuaries for a few years now, have done a fabulous job helping us through the development of HB 3158 and now through these second level reviews. And I'll turn it over to Jeannie. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. A brief introduction on myself. I'm a specialist leader with Deloitte. I'm actually out of the Dallas office, so I'm local to the city. I have 15 years of experience on benefit strategies, and I primarily focus on pensions as well as post-employment health plans. I'm an enrolled actuary as well as an associate of the Society of Actuaries. So today I'm going to be going through the results of our review as required by Texas Section Code 802. As mentioned previously, this is a requirement that this review is being done every 5 years, and it covers the DPFP plan as well as the ERF plan. Right now, we're presenting the results of the final report. Prior to this meeting, we had an opportunity to discuss the draft report with the board for DPFP as well as ERF, gather some feedback from them as well as responses from their actuaries. DPFP hires Siegel as their actuary, and ERF has GRS as their actuary. So we gathered feedback from them and incorporated that into this report. So the presentation here covers the final report for this section code requirement. So a couple of highlights from the valuation reports that we reviewed. The DPFP plan has a liability of about $4.5 billion, unfunded liability of about $2.4 billion, an annual benefit payment of about $300 million per year, and it covers about 5,000 actives as well as retirees, 5,000 retirees on top of that. For ERF, the liability is very similar. It's about $4.4 billion, annual benefit payment of about $260 million, and it covers 7,800 active employees and another 8,300 retirees in the plan. The reports that we reviewed were the most recently available report. It was issued in 2018 for both of the plans. So the purpose of this review is to validate that the work performed by the actuaries reflect actuarial standards of practice. The process that we went through to perform this review is to assess the assumptions, how it was determined, what information was used to develop the assumptions and methods, as well as reviewing the information that they presented in the report, such as the actuarially determined contribution, as well as the projection of how many years it would take to fully fund the plans. and also to review that the report is complete. It includes all the information required by actuarial standards of practice. And we also reviewed some test cases to make sure that the actuaries are valuing the people the way the plan should be interpreted, and the plan provisions of the plan are being incorporated into the evaluation accordingly. Some of the information that we included and we requested from the funds includes the data. We did some sampling of the data to make sure that they are accurate, compared that with what the actuary used. We looked at some outputs from the evaluation system to make sure that it's in line with what we were expecting. We also read through the recent evaluation report as well as the experience study to make sure that it's complete and has all the necessary information in it. So as a summary, it's our opinion that this most recent valuation reports and experience study for both DPFP and ERF are in compliance with actuarial standards of practice. Both of the plans perform experience studies every 5 years, and the analysis and the results from that experience study was reflected in the valuation report. The plan provisions and assumptions were appropriately reflected in the test cases that we received. So overall, no major issues. Everything looks good. It's in line with what we were expecting from the actuarial standards of practice. We did have a couple of recommendations, and we've relayed that to the funds. And these recommendations were just to provide suggestions on having more details in the report so that it can be more provide more clarity, and also some recommendations about additional things that they could consider including. So the next couple of slides, I'll be going through some of the highlights of the recommendations that we had. The full list is included in your packet in the appendix as well as the full report. But here are just some of the items that I'll bring up at this time. So the first thing that we recommended was for them to determine the actuarially determined contribution based on best practices of funding policy. Right now, both of the plans use a 30-year open amortization period, which essentially would never really pay off the unfunded liability for either plan. Based on the statutory requirements of the city's contributions, this number isn't required to determine what the contribution would be, but it would be best practice for the actuarially determined contribution to be a robust number. It should involve and reflect the fund's funding policy, as well as if there is a goal to fund the plan over a certain limited period of time, that it will reflect that as well. The Texas Pension Review Board also has a couple of funding guidelines around how to determine this contribution, and the suggestion is, it's as brief a moment as possible to amortize the unfunded liability, not to exceed 30 years. So there are some guidelines out there, even though it's not very prescriptive and it's not a requirement, but it's a suggestion. The actuaries also provided responses that they would consider our recommendation in the next valuations and further discuss it with each of the boards. The next recommendation that we had was to disclose the history of fully funded year. For a plan like DPFP and ERF, where the city contributions are statutorily fixed, it's a good idea to show this trend from year to year. This information is available in each of their report, but it will be useful to show a comparison of prior year against current year information, so it's easily accessible in one report. The next recommendation was to disclose a 10 to 20 year of undiscounted cash flow. Really what this is for the report to include a projection of how much benefit payments they're expecting to pay out each of the next 10 to 20 years, just to provide some kind of, expectation of how much benefit payments are being expecting to be paid out of the plan going forward. So the actuaries also responded that they will consider this. ERF, in fact, said that they will be adding this to the next valuation report. And then our review of the experience study, we noted that DPFP and ERF both had implemented a second tier benefits. For DPFP, it was for members who were hired after March 1st, 2011. For ERF, it was 12/31/2016 hires have a different tier of benefit. We notice in the report that they have a separate retirement assumption for this population. It's understandable that with the new tier of benefit, it's less valuable. People may choose to retire earlier or later as it relates to it. But we also suggested that they consider incorporating a withdrawal assumption. With a less valuable benefit, they might consider leaving the city earlier than expected. because of the they're not incentivized to stay based on the pension benefits. So that's the highlight of our recommendations. I'll take any questions if there are any.
All right. I want to thank you for that information. Ms. Clark.
Yep. I'm sorry to have these missed. Yeah, we can look at, well, is this the page numbers on here? The page that shows the plan highlights from the 2018 valuations. Page 3. So I'm looking at the unfunded liability for DPFP, and these are in
millions.
Millions. So two unfunded liability is $2,354 million. I thought Dan Flynn of the Texas legislature fixed the DPFP. A lot of people have been claiming that it's been fixed, that pension system. What happened? There's still $2.5 billion behind, and everybody's saying, I fixed the pension system?
So, as we talked about elsewhere in the presentation, or as Jeannie talked about, the pension deal assumes that things will be funded within a certain period of time. And so HB 3158, at the time that it passed, we knew it would be 100% funded in 40 years, but that it would take those 40 years to pay down this unfunded liability.
And how much are Dallas taxpayers paying over and above what they were paying to try to pay down this unfunded liability?
At the time of the legislation, we estimated that it would be about $40 million more per year in city contributions to that pension.
So the solution, the fix to the pension system, was to create an unfunded mandate to the Dallas taxpayers to bail out the system $40 billion a year above and beyond how much was being paid into the system at that point in time?
The about a 110, 120 at the time.
Right.
So our contribution
from $110 million to $140 million.
$156 million.
And we're still, I can't even get this number right, $2,354 million in unfunded liability. Doesn't sound like much of a fix from the legislature there. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Gates.
Thank you. And thank you for the presentation. Ms. Rage, so this presentation today is, have we done this in the past, like run our own actuaries, or we've always just relied on the pension systems themselves?
To my understanding, we've always relied on the pension okay. systems themselves until the point at which we realized that we had the issues that we did, and we brought on Deloitte to help us through the Dallas Police and Fire pension issues.
Okay. So, I'm glad we did this, and I'm glad also it shows, though, that the actuaries that both of the systems are using are – the numbers are close – the same, correct?
What it's showing is, and Jeannie, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that they are following the actuarial standards of practice. Now, any actuarial report is going to be heavily dependent on the assumptions that
right.
you make. So if I were to put together my own set of assumptions and have Deloitte run the valuation, I might end up with a little bit different result in terms of unfunded liability or in terms of other pieces of the analysis. However, what this review does is to take a look at where the actions and that the actuary for the pension plan took, were they reasonable and in line with practice and
okay.
the standards.
But
of
it
practice.
Was using the same assumptions.
They used, yes, they were looking at the assumptions that Siegel and GRS used.
Okay. So are we testing those assumptions to see how for any accuracy? I mean, like longevity and I know when I was on the police and fire pension, they were not, you know, that some of the assumptions were not, they weren't accurate. I mean, they were not, how do you put that? Making sure that, particularly longevity, that it was actually the longevity of the fire and police members themselves. You know, there's practices that you're supposed to look at those regularly to see if you're accurate.
Right, and I'd like to ask Jeannie to address what they looked at in terms of those kinds of assumptions. What I'll say is that our contract with Deloitte is a six-year contract. It includes not only these types of reviews, but other work. And so we can have Deloitte help us value things. If we think the assumption ought to be different than what one of the pension funds was using, we can work with Deloitte to value something different and maybe stress test or do some sensitivity analysis on some of those assumptions. So we have other pieces of the contract that we will be working with Deloitte over the years on to make sure that we have a real independent look. But in terms of longevity and other assumptions, I know that you've provided recommendations to the funds based on what they're doing.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to hear that from Jeannie then. Yeah,
sure.
If you think.
You know, as part of our review, we analyzed the assumptions that they use as well as what is used out there, like what assumptions are most recent. So, for example, you brought up longevity. They did reflect some of the studies based on the actual experience of the funds and the participants themselves. But there are also more recent studies that have been released, such as a mortality study specific for the public sector. We're expecting them to start incorporating that in the next experience study. I think it's expected in 2020.
Experience study, that was the word I was trying to come up with.
So as they're doing this experience studies every 5 years, you know, they'll start incorporating the more recent information. But as of now, based on our review, you know, they are looking at the right things. For example, even for the return on asset assumption, based on the asset allocations as well as the publicly available information on the returns, we're seeing that it's within a reasonable range. But that's not to say that, you know, different actuaries can be selecting different assumptions, but based on what they provided in the documentation and the assumption that they selected, it's within practice.
So it's pretty close. So their assumptions are close to the actual rate of return or not?
Their assumptions are validated based on the, you know, horizon of what asset allocations are expected to return in the future. In actuality, you know, the market would move.
Right. Okay. And then, so these two, we've got the liability related to these two pensions. Did we look at the liability related to the OPEB, the other benefits for retirees?
We did take a look at the OPEB plan as well. It's not required by this section of law that we look at that and present it, but we did, and happy to meet with you and talk through that plan as well.
Okay, but that's it. We also put it in, it's in the CAFR, right, the liability related to that?
The liability in the CAFR that we disclosed this year was a little over $500 million. I believe it may have been
$513 million. Yeah. Okay.
Right.
$513?
Right.
Okay, I would just like to see a chart of, you know, what that's projected, because it'll peak at one point, and then we will not, then it'll start going down.
Correct? That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Provide that.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Atkins?
Yes. On page three, Deloitte, the actuary in 2014, I think Deloitte, y'all did a study, y'all did something, a contract was hired by the pension fund to look at the actuary. I'm trying to find out the difference between that. Who did actuary, was the actuary contract in 2014? Who did that? It was another, I'm just trying to find out who was that for the pension fund.
For the police and fire pension?
Yes.
I will have to get back to you on who their actuary was at the time. I wasn't here at the city, and I'm not remembering if it was still Siegel at that time or if they had – they had a different actuary and switched to Siegel.
Right. And what I'm trying to figure out, the actuary at that time and when we hired Deloitte to do the actuary, was there a starting point or stopping point when you actually did your review? With the assets, unfunded liability, you know, what was the starting point?
For purposes of this, we reviewed the most recent valuation
report. And the most recent is December 31st, 2014.
So the valuation report is January 1st, 2018.
Okay.
That includes the most up-to-date liability and asset numbers. The experience study is done every 5 years, and it's doing an in-depth analysis to set their assumptions. To review, you know, mortality, withdrawal, retirement, even the asset allocations.
Okay. And
so that's specific to the assumptions, but the valuation is done every year to update the liability and asset results.
So how do we calculate the $40 million that we need to for the taxpayer to put back into the pension fund? How was that calculated, the $40 million? How did we come with the $40 million?
When we were examining the passage of HB 3158, so that would have been in June of 2017, and we're looking at the contributions required by the bill versus what we...
Could you tell me what was... I want to hear. Mm-hmm. What was the contribution on the bill? What was that?
It's about $155 to $160 million a year. It's increasing over the time frame of the bill. And so when we looked at what we were contributing and what we would have been contributing under the current city contribution rates in effect at the time, which was 27.5% of total pay, and the bill called for us to contribute 34.5% of computation pay. When we looked at that, it looked as if the calculation showed it would be about $40 million more a year that the city would need to contribute.
Is that $40 million per year in the next 5 years, or do they change on when do they change? I know you got to be.
It was $40 million per year for the next 5 years at that time, and then for 2 years following that, it was about $30 million a year. And then it would depend on the number of staff in place. And the reason is that the legislature put into place a minimum, a floor that the city would need to contribute for the first 7 years of the bill. And they also asked the city to contribute $13 million more per year for those 7 years. And so that's why we know what our contribution is for the first 5 to 7 years of the bill. After that, it's going to be dependent on how many police and fire staff we have on board.
So the contribution from the city there is $260 million over 7 years. Is that a fair statement?
I believe so, in addition to what we would have been contributing.
Well, what is the addition?
Well, so we were already contributing about $110 to $120
right.
million a year. So, and then you, you know, take the 40, and I'm going to do the math, yeah, $280 million more than we would have been contributing. So, and I don't have all of my numbers with me, but it's very significant in terms of the city contributions to the plan and over a period of time. And I can get these numbers to you.
And thank you, Lee, for letting me know it was Buck Consulting who was the actuary at that time. Did we ever go back and look at their actuary, what they figure what was going on versus when Deloitte came over? Was that something that we just started from scratch and start all back over because of the legislature?
Really what we did was we worked with Deloitte to do a fresh valuation. So, no, we did not go back and look at what Buck did. We looked at the current assets of the fund and valued the current liabilities. We worked with Deloitte on putting into on using certain assumptions for the plan, and we performed our own valuation that informed our negotiations on HB 3158.
Okay. So at the end of 7 years, walk me through what happened. Well, what's going to happen at the end of 7 years? You know, we got $280 million. We're going to put it in 7 years. We go back to that. So what happened after that?
Right. So the bill asks that in 5 years, an independent actuary take a look at the status of things and perform a valuation so that the parties can work together, if necessary, to present to the legislature any changes that may need to be made to the pension system, either benefits or contributions, in that seventh year. So we're on hold a little bit. You know, anytime you change a benefit structure, people's behavior may change based on that. So we needed some time and some experience to see how the behavior of the members in terms of when they choose to retire, et cetera, might change. And so we'll have that under our belts at the five-year mark. We'll take a look at all of that and determine, are there some additional changes that might benefit the plan?
Okay. So right now, as you stated, so the city dollars and the pension fund, we are better partners now than we was in the past, right? I've been going, so I'm trying to find the diligent, the information, everything's flowing, you know, nothing said, okay, we got to talk to the attorney before I release this. So all information that Deloitte Lee, the pension is giving them, complete the green light.
Yes, we have a good relationship with both pension funds. We've been able to obtain information. Jeannie, I don't know if there's anything you want to add.
No, that's right. We were able to get the necessary information that we need for the review from both funds.
Okay, review of both funds. So how often do the pension fund come back to the city of Dallas and give an update? You're doing that once a year now? I mean, when are we doing an update? The status of the pension fund, how are we doing the update now?
They publish their evaluation once a year.
No, I'm talking about how often do you or the representative from the pension fund come to the city council and tell us the update, what's going on? If that's a once a year deal now, what is, when is it?
Yes, they come once a year to the Government Performance and Financial Management Committee. They are scheduled. We have currently, and it's tentative, of course, based on when they're going to release all of their reports and just scheduling issues. But tentatively, we're looking at the police and fire pension coming in August to that committee, and that the ERF would come in October to that committee to present their yearly update.
Could you make sure, give me a timeline when they schedule to come in, you know, in August or September, so we get an update ahead.
Absolutely.
Of time. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Callahan.
Come back to me if you don't mind. I've got another question. I'm ready.
Okay. Ms. Kleiman, round two.
Yeah, thank you. I did want to ask you, Ms. Chen, about some of these assumptions, primarily assumed rate of return. What are the assumed rate of returns these two systems have now?
Let me look it up real quick.
I can help you. I think it's 7.25 for the Dallas Police and Fire.
Yes, 7.25.
Y'all said that seemed reasonable?
Yes, based on the publicly available information that we have on long-term returns on the asset allocations, the assumption is within the reasonable range.
And would you say that of the public pension systems, that rate of that assumed rate of return is right in the middle, or would it be an outlier? Where is it relative?
It is not an outlier. It's within, I would say, mid to high end.
One standard deviation, two standard deviations? If you compared it to ERISA plans, where would it be?
We'll have to get back to you on kind of the comparisons. I don't know that we have the comparisons to other plans readily available.
Right.
Okay, well, if we look at, I think it's page, I'm trying to figure out what page of your report this is on, the page that shows the actual returns, arithmetic as well as geometric, 4.46 over 10 years, 3.74 over 10 years. How can a 7.25 be even possible when the actual returns are 3% less, 3 points less than that? Looks like page 21 of your report. And how can we cause it is reasonable that they expect these kinds of returns when they haven't been able to achieve that in 10 years?
So when we're doing this valuation, this review, we're looking at it on a forward long-term horizon. And if you look at on page 23 of our report, we show the information that they provided based on the asset allocation as well as the long-term future expected returns by asset class and where they're coming in at. As you can see, it's based on the documentation, it was about 8.3%, and their assumption is 7.25. There were a couple of other studies
looking
that they quoted.
Forward-looking.
Sorry?
Forward-looking?
Forward-looking, yes.
Have they changed financial consultants over there, their primary consultant?
I am not certain. I know that the board, of course, as you do, is working very hard to change the asset mix, but I'm not sure if they've changed financial consultants. Yeah.
I'm just concerned that they have for years and years and years said they're going to get these kinds of returns and just never did. And for so long, we found that the kind of returns they say they were going to get were just made up. How was it determined that this return, anticipated return number? Who decided that?
Their board did, and they've
right.
had
So they just made up a number and threw it out there, and we accepted that.
Well, yes, and as does the ERF. Their board considers things and sets a return. And so, as you note, the return currently assumed in DPFP is 7.25, and for the ERF, it is 7.75. And so those are both rates of return that certainly if we could lower them, I would support that. I think regardless of what the benchmark is, et cetera, what past performance has been, I think if we lower the assumed rate of return, it lowers any risk in the plan and enables the investments to be, the mix to be potentially a little bit safer,
right,
with a lower rate of return. So that's, you know, advisable if we can do it. I know both boards have talked about doing that over time as they are able to do so. And certainly, as you know from your service on the ERF board, they did lower it 0.25 from 8%. So I think that's something we're all paying attention to.
But what also happens to the liability when you lower the rate of return?
Well, if you lower the rate of return, the unfunded liability goes up.
Right.
So there's a balance.
Are these boards just so afraid of making their unfunded liability look even bigger than it really is, maybe more to the truth, and that's why they're not actually lowering their assumed rate of returns?
I obviously can't speak for the boards. You, being a board member, might be able to, but...
Yeah. That's what I believe, and I've expressed it there. Thank you.
Ms. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor, and thank you for the report. I really appreciate it. I know you have gone to a lot of hard work and doing trends over data that we've had versus, you know, data that's forthcoming. But I'm like Mr. Kleiman on that assumption rate of 7.75. Elizabeth, you and I had a private conversation a while back, and I think you said this last year we reached that benchmark, or we were very close, I think.
In the ERF, yes, they have done very well in terms of meeting their mark. The market this last year and the final quarter, in fact, the month of December 2018, was a very rough market. It was not good for the ERF. As of the first quarter of this year, they had regained all of that loss from December. And then, of course, we've had the very recent issues in the market, and that's been a problem once again. So we've seen a lot of volatility in the market, and so we'll see kind of where things end up.
I know you have to start with an assumption somewhere, and we've certainly benefited by lowering those expectations, but you know, while we may have reached those in the past year or so, sustainability is the hard thing to do over a lengthy period of time to achieve those kind of benchmarks at 7.25 as well as 7.75. And that concerns me. Of course, the legislature is requiring that we put in the extra $40 million, which is anywhere from 110 to 120, that's 150 to 160 million overall. And yet, when we get to the 5-year point, to the reconciliation point, we may not be able to bring the ends together, and we still may have to make additional contributions there to fulfill that because the assumption rate, in our view, is possibly faulty. That's where we get in trouble. We don't get in trouble now, but we'll get in trouble in perhaps 5 or 7 years. That's what disturbs me. And we know we've got about a 36-year window that we're going to have to basically come together, you know, when the lines actually meet together, and that's without any COLAs. So it could be, in my viewpoint, if we don't reach those benchmarks, disastrous once we get to that point. So that's what troubles me when you use those kind of assumptions. And I recognize that you would be much more comfortable to have something less. I thought something more real in today's market might have been candidly 5 or 6 as opposed to the 7.25, and that's on the police fire. And I know that doesn't sit well, and in terms of politics, it doesn't sell well because they were used to getting 8 or 8.5. But I think if we're really honest with ourselves and being candid, I think we're going to have to look at a lower assumption rate. Otherwise, into perpetuity, we're going to be putting in a huge amount of extra money and perhaps even looking at bond campaigns every 5 years to fulfill that obligation. So those are where my concerns are at. Now, the 34.5%, that's what we're paying basically now, but that's $40 million on top of that 34.5%. Is that correct?
The amount that we are contributing now is actually more than 34.5% of computation pay, and that's
because. What would that be?
Well, the bill has a floor in it. So what it said was if we weren't, you know, we would calculate 34.5% of computation pay, but if that wasn't enough to be at a certain level, we would contribute the higher amount. So we are currently, if you using our existing police and fire staffing and the existing salaries were to calculate 34.5%, it does not reach the level of that floor. So we are contributing the floor plus $13 million, and that's where you get that roughly $156 million this year that we are contributing.
So, in your viewpoint, do you feel like we're fulfilling our obligation at those rates, or do we still today, based on what we know, really need more capital infused into the system?
We are absolutely fulfilling our obligation by law.
Yeah. By law, yes.
Yes.
Right. Now, the other thing is that will we need legislative approval when we do those adjustments or reconciliations come 5 years from now?
Yes, this is a state statute retirement plan for the DPFP. And so, yes, we would need to have the legislature approve changes.
So they're in the enabling legislation, there is an extension requirement within that. Is that right?
Right. The legislation calls for that independent actuary hired. I don't know if it's hired by the State Pension Review Board or recommended by the State Pension Review Board, but that state board is involved in selecting that actuary to perform the work that then might inform changes.
Now let's assume that everything that we're doing achieves the goals that we want. Once we get to 2053, then we would grab that assumption at 2% COLA, or would that be based on the inflation rate, CPI rate, or how do we get there?
So for the cost of living adjustment in the police and fire pension plan, the legislation eliminated a cost of living adjustments, however, gave the board the ability to consider granting a cost of living adjustment once the plan is 70% funded.
Right.
And so that is quite a ways out, and while we may, for our long-term planning, make some assumptions around that, it's quite some time before the board is going to be able to consider whether to grant that.
If we looked at the plan today, what would be the percentage of fulfillment? I'm sure it's below 70%.
The funded percentage right now is right around 50%.
I was thinking somewhere near.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see if we've got anything else. I think that's all I have right at the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kingston.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. May I ask Mr. Kleinman a question?
Sure.
Mr. Kleinman, the last couple of times that the ERF has updated council or the council committees on their performance and their plans, I've been given the impression that staff was going to bring to the ERF board further recommendations for reducing the bogey, and that doesn't seem to be happening. Do you have a sense for when or if that will happen?
So we review that each year early in the year, and the board, again, sets the assumed rate of return, and despite efforts on my part and a few others on the board, we were unable to move them down. They are still convinced that they're better investors in the market.
Well, for
but
what
I'll
it's,
continue to work at.
Yes, for what it's worth, I support your efforts, and thank you for continuing to help the ERF.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Did the DPFP wind up suing Buck?
I'm not familiar with whether they did or not. I certainly can have Ms. Gottschalk.
You know, let's follow up on that, and also more generally the forensic work that the DPFP did in the wake of the disaster. The plan that I believe that we voted for when I was serving there with other colleagues here today would have created a very complete picture of certain professionals' liability for negligence or even malfeasance in service to the DPFP, and I think Buck was one of those that was in the crosshairs. I'm not certain it still has corporate existence. So we had, you know, obviously one board can't tell the next one what to do, but we had left with the strong statement that once the forensic work was done and there was no more litigation to try to recover any of the pensions funds, that that report be made public, particularly so that the beneficiaries of the plan could see that the board had fulfilled its fiduciary duty to chase down every dollar that might be out there. So let's just send a polite inquiry to Ms. Gottschalk about where they are in that process and when we could expect to see that report. Because I think the report, the main question I get asked about my service over there is, why isn't anybody in prison? And I think that at a minimum, the forensic legal work that Diamond McCarthy did is going to at least answer a few of the questions that really frustrated beneficiaries have and frustrated taxpayers have about what happened over there. You know, we did what we had to do, and I'm proud of the work we did, but never have I had a more distasteful experience doing the right thing. And we need some sunshine on that difficult period so that people can understand that we really did do what we had to do. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation. Next presentation, Mr. Broadnax.
Thank you, Mayor. And Elizabeth will stay up there. The Office of Budget, Elizabeth today, I don't know if Jack and Jeanette are coming up, they're walking up now, is here to present the fourth briefing today on property tax exemption for individuals age 65 and over or disabled. As you recall, on December 13, 2017, Council added financial management performance criteria number 23 that required a comparison of the current exemption for individuals age 65 or older or disabled to the most recent annual consumer price index, CPI, every 2 years, calculated each odd-numbered year. The age 65 and older or disabled exemption was last increased from $64,000 to $90,000 on June 28, 2017. Today's briefing provides an opportunity to discuss the analysis and recommendation. If approved today, the City Council consideration for this item and to change the current exemption will be presented to Council via addendum agenda on June 12th. I'll turn it over to Jack at this point. Thank you.
Hey, Jack, if you'd like, you can hit the high points. I'm okay. Sure I had an opportunity to look over it.
Okay. We'll move pretty quickly through it then. Thank you and good afternoon. As Mr. Broadnax said, we're going to go through a little bit background and then discuss our over 65 exemption. So moving on to slide 3, just as background, as you know, property tax is our largest single revenue. Nearly $990 million a year is received through property tax. Property tax is based on value, exemptions, and our tax rate set by the City Council each year. In regards to exemptions, on the next slide, you'll see the exemptions are defined by state law. We cannot exempt a property from taxes unless it's allowed through state law. Exemptions, while they reduce the liability for the property owner, they also reduce the revenue that comes to the city to support city services. There's a little bit of information on the slide regarding the exemptions in Dallas. We have about 370,000 parcels that have some type of exemption, either a partial exemption or a total exemption. We exempt about $37 billion of value, which affects our revenues by about $280 million a year. We don't collect taxes because we are exempting the value. On slide 5, as I mentioned, some properties are totally exempt, such as schools, churches, and government properties. Some properties are partially exempt. The case of that would be such as our residential homestead exemption and our individuals that are age 65 and older are with a disability. These two exemptions on slide 6, you'll see that the City Council has approved them. Back 33 years ago, City Council established our age 65 and older exemption. Most recently, though, 2 years ago, the City Council increased that exemption to $90,000. We wanted to compare ourselves with others, so we looked at data available through Dallas, Collin, and Denton appraisal districts and compared ourselves with 88 other cities. You can see the data there about the residential homestead exemptions. As you know, Dallas is 20% homestead exemption. Nobody has one higher because we're at the maximum allowed by state law. There's 55 cities that are in this three-county area that we were looking at that have no homestead exemption at all. Regarding the age 65 and older or disabled exemption, as I mentioned, we increased ours up to $90,000 2 years ago. The average of the 88 cities is about $39,000. There are three cities in this area that have over 65 exemptions that are greater than ours, those being Richardson and Flower Mound, who both have a $100,000 exemption. But it's interesting to know that neither of those two cities offer any type of homestead exemption. The one city that's probably more generous than us is University Park. They have the 20% homestead exemption, plus they have a higher over 65 exemption. So that's just a little bit of background regarding property tax and the exemption that we have. But the main reason we're here is to talk about going forward with our over 65 exemption and our compliance with the financial management performance criteria. So I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Whedon, who will walk you through the next two or three slides about that.
So as previously mentioned, in December of 2017, City Council approved FMPC 23. Which requires a comparison of the age 65 or older disabled exemption to the most recent CPI every 2 years for a possible increase. As you know, CPI is a common way to measure price over time and is commonly associated with cost of living adjustment increases. On slide number 10, although FMPC requires a review of the most recent annual CPI, staff recommendation is actually based on an annual calculation of each year of the 2 years. So, using this frequency of adjustment, we calculated the annual growth rate from April of 2017 through April 2018, and then again April 2018 through April 2019. With this approach, the total growth equals 4,050, and rounding up, staff recommends an increase to this exemption from 90,000 to 94,100. On slide number 11, we have a table that shows in column one the current exemption value of 90,000, as well as the current revenue foregone. The data in the first column is actually based on certified values as of June 2018. The second column, which is column two, option A, this column reflects the most recent CPI analysis. So this compares the CPI from April 2018 through April 2019, an annual increase of 2%, and with this option, the change in exemption would be 1,800. Total revenue foregone is approximately 600,000, and residents would realize a change in their tax bill based on the current tax rate of approximately $14. The third column shows option B, which reflects staff's recommendation. Again, this is the two-year calculation approach where we look at the first year and then the second year, and combined together, that increases the total exemption by 4,050, and staff is recommending a change of 4,100. With this approach, total revenue foregone is approximately $1.3 million, and residents will realize a change in their tax bill of approximately $32. On the last slide, next steps, as mentioned, based on your approval today, you will consider a June 12th addendum to change the current age 65 or older disabled exemption. We will communicate that information to the appraisal districts by their deadline of June 30th. And then just as a reminder, on June 18th, we will come before you again to brief the biannual budget development process, as well as the impact of Senate Bill 2 on our property tax collections. So thank you, and at this time, we will take questions.
Thank you very much. Ms. Gates.
And thank you, Mayor, and thank you for bringing this forward, because we need to take action next week, right, to be able to let the taxing authority know. And so option A and B, one is just is not taking into that, they wouldn't, the CPI from that 17 to 18 would not be considered. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it's like, so this came through my committee when we made the change originally, and I think the intent was that we maintain the CPI annually. So I would be supportive. I'm not sure why we put it that we would look at it every 2 years, maybe because we were thinking it was easier to budget that way, but I would be supportive of the option B, which is what I think was the intent, is that we would, we raised it and then we were indexing it to CPI annually. So thanks. Those are my comments.
All right. Mr. Klein.
Thank you. If we can look at page 4 and 5. So on page 4, page 4, it shows we have $280 million foregone revenue due to exemptions. Is that all these exemptions that you talk about on page 5, which would be church, government, school, right, as well as our...
Yes, sir. It is everything, all inclusive, totally exempt, partially exempt.
Can you break that down between what exemptions are by ordinance and what exemptions are by other things and others?
We can. I don't have that level of detail with us, but we can absolutely
get you
that.
Kind of a guesstimate?
No.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we can tell you that City Council has the authority to approve the homestead exemption in over 65.
Right.
You have approximately 178,000 parcels with the homestead exemption. That value is $82.6 million. And then the over 65 disabled exemption, approximately 68,000 parcels, and the value of that is approximately $38
million. 38,
Total exempt properties, 11.
So if it's $120 million that we're exempting,
correct,
which would leave there's $160 million that's exempt for other reasons.
Correct. There's right, Freeport, okay, total exemption.
Okay. Okay, that's great. Okay, thank you. So if we look at page 6, it says that in 1986, we increased the exemption from 50,000 to 64,000. And I know the answer to this, so, but I'm going to ask it rhetorically. Do you know what that would be in today's dollars, the 64,000? And the answer is 147,000. Right.
Thank
so
you. I was trying to remember it from the last time you asked that question.
I didn't text it to you this time. I texted the answer. So if we had kept up with inflation since 86, we'd be at 147,000 in exemption. Okay. So if we look at page 11, absolutely, I think you guys really did catch the intent of the council, which was to keep up with inflation, even though we maybe didn't quite word it right. So I appreciate that very much. But when you look at the total revenue foregone, what would happen if we took the exemption up to $100,000? How much revenue would we be foregoing?
I didn't
well,
that.
I mean, we went from 90 to 90. If we go from 90 to 94, it's about $1.3 million. So if we go again another five or 6,000, I figure about another 1.5, 1.6 million. So maybe with a mere 3 million in exemption, we could give our seniors $100,000 exemption and be, you know, as high as anyone in the area. So I think when y'all come back on June 12th, you know, maybe be prepared for such a proposal, because I think the opportunity to give an exemption is important to keep seniors in their homes, and that's why I supported when we started this effort and would like to continue it. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to Councilmember Callahan, I think in the past something's been effective. If anyone has any suggestions, as Councilmember Kleiman talked about $100,000, why don't we send those to Councilmember Gates, and you can give a deadline maybe Friday or so. No, I'm just saying you. If anyone has any ideas for you related to what's being presented, okay. Right, midway by the meeting next Wednesday, you know, you'll already have a list of some potential options as well. So, all right, Mr. Callahan.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mayor, and I was proud of Lee being involved in that effort, and I certainly provided some level of leadership to get us to that exemption level. And with the higher valuations that we've experienced over the last 6 years, I think in my district 6 years in a row, this is very meaningful. I wish we could have kept up with inflation. Lee kind of stole my thunder on that, but and certainly it would be about $135,000, $145,000 range had we continued to do that. But I think $100,000 could be a good sweet spot, something that we could do. I know this is going to be a tough budget year. We've been all reminded of that. But we have to do something. There's a lot of hardworking people that make a lot of money that live in the northern part of the city that as they begin to retire, they're faced with really huge tax bills unless they have some level of exemption. Even I was talking to Eloy Villafranca, you know, FDIC this morning. He said, if I were to retire today, he said, I would have to sell and leave because I can't afford those kind of taxes unless I'm working and, you know, I have a gainful employment, not a retirement income. But that will certainly help our seniors down in the southern half as well. So I'd like to see us continue to do that. And I think Ms. Gates asked, why do we do it every 2 years? Because I think we're on a two-year budget footing that enables us to make those adjustments because we're looking at basically a two-year budget. Thank you for the time, Mayor.
If I may, I have an answer to the $100,000. So in looking at things, if we were to add a column, an option C column, and change it to $100,000, the total revenue foregone would be $3.4 million. So changing from $90,000 to $100,000 is a $3.4 million revenue foregone for a $78 reduction in the tax bill.
All right. Ms. Yates.
Okay. Lee, thank you very much for that motion. I really appreciate it, especially from the north. hey, you know, I look at the seniors. You know, the seniors is really getting over the population 65 years of age, and we look at West Dallas and we look at other parts of the city, you know, from going to from $60,000 to $90,000, that was a $30,000 jump. You know, they waited for many, many years. I mean, 10, 15, 20 years for us to understand, you know, why we should, you know, take care of the seniors. And the seniors are living longer. Their income is going down. We have not been doing a good steward to make sure the seniors is not getting overpriced in taxes. And Elizabeth, you know, doing those calculations, $3 million, I think that they've been waiting a long time. I mean, we have faced this issue for the last 12 years since I've been on council, back and forth. Why should they get more exemption? And I believe they should do it. But the CPI and the 2% on option B, the inflation is going up, it's not going down. Is that 2% a real number of the CPI? I mean,
well, it is calculated by the federal government, yes.
Right. But we look at different part of the cities, different part of the state, different part of the region. You know, it's different depending on where you live at. You look at Universal Park, Highland Park, or Frisco. There is a difference. I mean, there is not a same value of growing. Could you?
That is correct.
Right.
For the purpose of this analysis, we use the U.S. Calculation across the United States. We didn't use the regional number because it's less, it's more volatile and subject to error. So we used the U.S. calculation. We could have chosen region. We could have chosen Dallas-Fort Worth. However, those two metrics are more volatile.
But if you chose the University Park or Highland Park or somewhere, that would be higher, right?
Well, University Park, Highland Park, that's not an option. Dallas, Fort Worth, Arlington is an option to use as a metric. Unfortunately, based on the analysis and the best practices, it's best to use the U.S. Across all cities, not just looking at a specific region.
Okay. Going to, I think, one page that when we first started doing the tax exemption, I forgot what slide that on. What page is that? the history. And I think the answer was that if we did the exemption now, it would be probably, what, 100 and what, Elizabeth?
I think about $140,000.
So we're really about $40,000 short, according to the CPI, right? So therefore, we show we're still way behind. And Lee, thank you for bringing it up. I'm going to bring it up, you know, also. I think the $100,000, we should go there because this thing is needed. And I will be sending a letter to Ms. Gates this afternoon. I ain't going to wait till Friday. I'll make sure she get it today. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Narvaez.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see the regional numbers just to so we can compare and contrast. And I get, you know, the best standard in the practice, but I'd just like to see what, you know, I think at this council we should see the differences, even if, you know, it may not be the best practice, but how would it affect our senior citizens that are here locally at a different level. I will definitely would sign on to Mr. Kleinman if he makes that motion for 100. I really liked hearing the $147,000 motion, but I don't think we can afford it at this point. And I think I would send Ms. Rage over the ledge. We said $147,000 because I don't think we can afford it in any way.
We can't afford anything.
Right, let's be clear.
Right.
We can't afford anything. So, I do think that $100,000 and plus it's a little bit more even of a number that we can, you know, go out there. When we went from 64 to 90. Seniors understood 90,000. They're going to understand 100,000, you know, just to keep math simple for folks. And I would definitely like to see that option C on there if we could. And if we could just make option B 95,000, so we could just see the difference. Because at 94.1, again, it's confusing to people on how they do their calculations and look at things. But that's just my recommendation, my suggestion, but definitely – Mr. Atkins, if you're sending a letter, save me some time. Just add my name to it, and I'll be more than happy to stop by your office and sign it so we can send it to Ms. Gates' committee to take a look at. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Sorry. I needed to say on the seniors, you know, sorry about this. They played hard. I mean, some of them played hard, but they played by the rules. They worked really hard. They paid their taxes over all these years, and now that they're retired, you know, their incomes are flat. Some of them it's going down because things are just getting more and more expensive, and we want to keep them in the city of Dallas. And it doesn't matter in my district whether they live in Midway Hollow or they're in West Dallas. You know, they're getting pushed out, and they're starting to really feel this pinch. And these are the senior citizens in our district. And, you know, the ones in Midway Hollow, yeah, they're getting pushed out too. And, yeah, their homes are valued at a higher rate, so they might be able to stay in the city by downsizing and getting something a little smaller. But the folks that are most vulnerable senior citizens that are on those very fixed incomes, SSI and whatnot, you know, any little change in just their taxes on their homes can put them out of their home because they can't pay anymore. And they feel bad because everything else for all those years, they did it the right way. And at the end, we as a city, we should be telling them we're going to still take care of them. So let's try to figure it out, and I'll definitely support that $100,000. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Atkins, last comment.
Question, Ms. Rachel. When do we give an estimate of how much property revenue tax they will receive? When will we have that?
We will not receive the certified roll until July 25th. So, you know, we won't know for certain. However, we have preliminary figures, and we are tracking those as appeals occur. And on the 18th of June, we're going to be giving you kind of the current tracking of what that revenue looks like, understanding that it may erode some more before we get the final roll on the 25th of July.
Before the appeal, is the trend going up 10%, 3%? What are you seeing?
It is going up. So last year in the biennial budget, we had an assumption of 6.25% property value growth. We're seeing it come in higher than that. It could be as high as 9% again, but we're also, as I said, continuing to track the erosion.
Right. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation.
And may I add one more thing? I apologize. I wanted to just as I think this will be useful information for you, that it's not just the senior exemption. Folks will also receive the homestead exemption, the 20%. So I wanted to give you the value of the home that would not pay any taxes. So under option B, which is $94,100 in terms of the senior exemption, if a senior had a home at $118,000, received the 20% homestead exemption, and then the $94,100 exemption, they would not have a tax bill from the city. From the city. The value of the home, $118,000. At a $100,000 exemption for seniors, the value of the home would be $125,000 that then would not see a tax bill from the city. So I thought that might be an important piece of information.
Finished? All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Johnson.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and recite the speaker guidelines. Speakers must observe the same rules of propriety, decorum, and good conduct applicable to members of City Council. Any speaker making personal, impertinent, profane, or slanderous remarks, or who becomes boisterous while addressing the City Council, shall be removed from the room. Individuals are given 3 minutes to speak. You'll notice the time at the monitor in front of you. When your time is up, please stop. Address your comments to Mayor Thomas only. Also, if you have any handouts, go ahead and hand it to the officer to my right. Marcus Russell, not present. Freddie Delgado, canceled. Barry Sage, not present. Obias Barnett.
God bless you all. I'd like to thank Jesus Christ for putting me in front of many beautiful men and women and officials of our city. I'm a pastor here in Dallas, Texas, and I have a church called This Rock. We have a community outreach program called He Cares. Today my mission is simple. Mayor, I would like, if possible, I'm petitioning that the city get behind the churches that do want to get involved to save and restore our streets and in our community in Dallas, Texas. I'm currently servicing through Alpha and Preston all the way down to South Buckner. We're addressing the physical, spiritual, and environmental needs of our city by feeding and supplying those men and children and women that are homeless in our city. But we don't have the platform. We don't have the resources for the churches that do want to be involved. And today, Mayor Thomas, I'm petitioning that the city get behind us. As I heard last time we spoke, that you guys are very invested in the church. Unfortunately, I never heard anything back concerning what you guys would do and want to work with us about this project. And I would like to finally have a meeting with your committee and you all to finally have that talk. With murder being at an all-time high, with poverty in our city being at an all-time high, I think it's time that the church and the mayor and your committee, we all sit down and devise a plan that we can save and restore the community of Dallas, Texas. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Joanne Rohn, not present. Sandra Crenshaw.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, where is, oh, Mr. Thomas is, thank you. Excuse me, just a minute. I last time I talked with you guys, I told you that I run for public office each year so that I can have the opportunity to address the business community and address the voters, trying to get them to pay attention to what we need to have is an open and transparent government. I at the very beginning of this election cycle, I filed an open records request to have all of the emails and the residence address of all of the candidates, 68 candidates. Madam Secretary redacted all of the candidates that were attorneys. And there is no requirement or any code that allows them to do that. After doing additional research, my opponent, Calvin Johnson, had not ever voted in District 7 and had registered at the last minute and filed an affidavit that he lived in the district. Mayoral candidate Eric Johnson was told that he requested that his information not be public because he didn't want anybody out there protesting at his house. Well, the state open record says that all applications for a place on the ballot are public information. Our city attorney came up with some excuses and failed and ignored number four that says accept a public record. So therefore, I am asking that this council direct the city attorney to disclose all 68, the public record that is in all 68 applications. Now, I did give notice to the city that I'm asking the Fifth Court of Appeals to issue a writ compelling Madam Secretary to produce these items. The Court of Appeals, of course, is just as much political as you are as elected officials, and they're dragging their feet, and they're hoping that I don't have everything in place that they're asking for before the deadline so that my issue would be moot. So therefore, I'm announcing that we will be at Eric Johnson's residence, at least the residence that we have on DCAD, and have a protest and walk up and down and ask all his neighbors, does he live there? That's one thing. Secondly, we also have the option to go to Travis County District Court to compel the city to quit withholding the information, and I'm told that that is an offense for a government body to withhold public information. We can avoid all of that if we just ask the council to direct Madam Secretary to release the public information on the applications for a place on the ballot.
Thank you very much.
B.M. Randolph.
Hallelujah. It's getting gooder and gooder.
All right.
All right. My voice is a little hoarse, but I am going to sing you, even if it's just a bar of a song. I'm here to tell you, first of all, the city secretary's office left out the word buck from my title. I did it. Oh, I registered over the phone. I said buck naked. I went there. They had eliminated and I said buck naked. I'm from the country. I'm putting it back in. My title correctly should read The Buck Naked Truth. This is from heaven. The Lord basically allowed me to hear this, and you need to hear it. Please don't try to read it for me. I am very educated. I'm a teacher also. It's never right to do wrong, to do right. I have an example. I'm going to say it again. It is never right to do wrong, to do right. DACA is one of the best examples that's coming to my mind right now. I didn't know that much about DACA, but I understand that there were a lot of Hispanics, and I love all people. I know Spanish too, a little bit. Okay. What happened, a lot of the illegals came over, and then they had children over here. Well, see, we should have nipped it in the bud at the entrance of this city, this country. We are a Judeo-Christian nation, and they take advantage of our weaknesses. But see, some of that is illiterate, ignorant, gone to seed. Talking about good for your neighbor, where's the clock? Good for your neighbor and all that. So what it is, God said he has given every country, or every people a country. He gave Mexico, the Mexicans, Mexico. He gave the Spaniards, Spain. He gave the Africans, Africa. I don't need to go on any further. Everybody should be grooming their own place. But because we have sacrificed so much, our life, our health, our strength, everybody wants to come over here to this fertile land, but they don't want to obey the rules of God. Lord, I want to be a Christian. in my heart, in my heart, Lord, I want to be a Christian. In my heart, in my heart, Lord, I want to be a Christian in my heart.
This concludes your speakers, Mr. Mayor.
226, meeting adjourned.